Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads, featuring illuminated manuscripts, metalwork, carvings, and works by contemporary Ethiopian artists. On view now. For tickets and more information, you can visit PEM.org.
And Safety Insurance, offering auto insurance policies designed to help for when the worst happens. You can ask an independent agent about safety insurance. Safety Insurance. We'll help you manage life's storms.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, is a Trump versus Biden rematch in the offing? And what does it mean that Mitch McConnell caves on that debt limit issue? Hopefully, NBC's Chuck Todd will have answers when he joins us in a few.
Former President Donald Trump has dipped his toe into Massachusetts politics, endorsing Republican gubernatorial candidate Jeff Deal over Charlie Baker, whom he's accused of being a rhino. That's Republican in name only, and he said it more than once. In most United States, a Trump endorsement could make the difference in an election, but here in Massachusetts, is it more like a kiss of death for Deal or a significant problem for Baker? We'll open the lines to hear your thoughts. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So join us online to talk about all things political is Chuck Todd. Chuck's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most local providers. Also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Hello, Chuck Todd.
Well, hello there.
Well, hello to you.
Hello, Chuck Todd. So we have a headline on the front page of the Boston Globe today, Republicans back down, offer fix on debt ceiling. And it talks about how Mitch McConnell, of course, he's the minority leader in the Senate, made a tactical retreat. So you don't often see those words together, Mitch McConnell. What's going on?
Well, it's all about you had to find out what could you take from him that he cared about. And it turned out it's the filibuster. And when Manchin and Sinema showed some openness to using a carve-out on the filibuster for the debt limit, suddenly McConnell got some weak knees. That's significant. It means that, you know, that there was a pain threshold. And I think a lot of people wondered, was there a pain threshold here? But it's only 2 months. But it does buy Democrats time to focus on what they should be focused on, which is getting to an agreement on how much they plan on spending on the president's agenda, because this is absolutely turning into a political spiral of problems. So getting him to back down is not an insignificant moment.
And by the way, just to be clear, so his worry was if Biden, Sinema, and Manchin decide to get rid of the filibuster to do the debt limit thing, then maybe they get emboldened and do it more. Is that the feeling? Is once the door
That's
is open?
That's exactly right. Okay. Once the door's open, you start to create carve-outs for debt limit.
Got it.
Then the carve-out for voting rights is suddenly
more palatable.
Exactly. So I think it's intriguing that's what moved McConnell. And I think it does show you, he wants to keep the filibuster under any circumstance. I think some people thought, well, he'd love to force the Democrats to start this process and then he'll finish it. He doesn't want to get rid of the filibuster, even if Republicans are in charge. That's an important development.
Why, even if Republicans are in charge? Why is that important development?
I think the fact that he believes there should be filibuster, even if Republicans are in charge, I think that's if he wanted to go down the party line rule, in the long term, it does benefit Republicans. They're more likely to be in charge of the Senate than the Democrats. That's just the way our current system works, with, you know, every state getting two senators. So I think the fact that McConnell really doesn't, and I think we know what it is. It means, you know, I've always believed that his great fear is having to catch the car of some of the crazy right-wing ideas. And, you know, The filibuster is an easy excuse to keep the crazy on the right from getting traction. So, you know, I think that's where McConnell's actually coming from.
Well, but we should make clear, obviously, when it comes to Supreme Court justices, he's fine with 50 votes being the threshold.
You're absolutely right. On judges, this became, right, Democrats, but look what he did. This is what my point is. So when, you know, he went further on Supreme Court justices than the Democrats did, but he waited until the Democrats did it first. Here was an opportunity to let the Democrats open the door on this, and he didn't want to follow them through on this one. That's my point here. He was more than willing on judges, but he doesn't want to do it on policy, and that to me, like I said, it's an important development.
You know, before we leave this topic, you made what I thought was a really interesting point last week about the Democrats playing the same game on the debt stuff, or else they just dump this artificial limit. I want you to know used it several times on TV last week without crediting you at all, so I felt pretty good about it. So could you explain briefly for people who missed last week what your point was?
Well, that was the other thing. It was get rid of the weapon, right? It's a stupid weapon. There isn't no reason for it to exist, this idea of an artificial limit on what debt will do. So the Democrats ought to, like, fine, he wants to play games with it. Well, make sure it can't ever be done again. And there's a couple of different ways to do it. And the easiest way to do it is to create a reverse incentive, and Congress, you have to get two-thirds of Congress to disapprove. Basically, the president has the power to lift the debt limit, but unless there's a two-thirds majority in Congress to stop him. And that would essentially take the issue off the table permanently.
And your point is, if the Democrats didn't want to play the exact same game when they're in a minority that the Republicans do, they'd do that. I thought that was great.
That's what frustrates. It's like, what other explanation is there?
None.
Right.
Do you think the fact that McConnell did do this has an impact on Manchin and Sinema in terms of the filibuster, or it just doesn't even matter?
Look, I mean, Manchin himself has said he's open to some filibuster reform, that it is being abused. I do think there is some room here with him on this. But that's all it is. I'd say there's room. But it is for reform. I don't know why Democrats haven't come up with that reform. You know, to me, you know, you have Manchin agreeing to reforms of the filibuster, so create the reform.
Yeah.
Force a talking filibuster. Some stuff around the edges to at least make it more difficult.
Oops, lost you for a second there. You know, one quick thing. We've heard so much about Manchin, analysis of Manchin. I'm hearing more about analysis of Kyrsten Sinema. What's the 32nd? What is she about?
I think that's what everybody's trying to figure out. I'm not going to sit here. I mean, this is, you want to talk about Washington's new favorite parlor game, which is trying to figure out who is Kyrsten Sinema and what motivates her. I mean, it is, I do think she's one of these anti-heroes, meaning like she enjoys being talked about, but doesn't want to talk about it. But that doesn't mean she doesn't enjoy being talked about, right? There is Maureen Dowd did the Greta Garbo comparison, but the problem with that is who under 60 can really fully appreciate the Greta Garbo comparison? I mean, I really can't. I'm not going to lie to you. I know what she was trying to say, but look, I don't know. I think a lot of people are wondering what makes her tick, and I think you got to be careful here. What if she quits? You know, some people say she doesn't enjoy this. What if she quits as a Republican governor? You know?
Yeah.
Would she switch parties? On paper, it doesn't make sense, but I can give you a whole slew of party switchers that never made sense to me on paper. You never know what moves a person. And I do think there is enough Democrats are nervous about spooking her that I do think that there ought to be a lighter touch on this criticism of her.
We're talking to Chuck Todd. Marjorie and I are broadcasting from the women's room at GVH, by the way. So Trump's running, right? Is Trump running?
I think he wants everybody to assume he's running, but what does running look like? You know, I think he's always going to want to force everybody to decide. So I think it's possible that it doesn't look like a campaign if he runs. But yes, I just assume he's running until he doesn't file.
What does that mean? Just flesh out what you said a minute ago, what it looks like, and what does that mean? I mean, we read the thing the other day that his advisor said don't declare yet for a whole variety of reasons. But you mean he'll just be on the periphery?
I just think he'll, like, just barnstorm when he needs to, but it won't be a constant. He'll just try to run from it. He'll do what he did the last time. He'll just try to run from his airplane cockpit, but might not even do that many events. Maybe two or three a week.
You know,
he runs as the nominee to be without having to play the primary game, but he'll do just enough.
While the Pences and the Haleys do their sycophant thing along the way.
Try to run as a, maybe Chris Christie tries, people like that. They don't get much traction.
I was looking at your commentary the other day about an issue that I'm obsessed with, these quote audits. And you talked about a couple of states. Can you bring people up to speed on what Republicans are doing around these phony audits a la Arizona?
Well, my new favorite one is apparently the state of Florida, Republicans in the state of Florida demanding a so-called audit. This is the same state of Florida where the governor there, Ron DeSantis, said it was a model for how to run an election. So, but Lake County Republicans have voted in, and now he's got to figure out what to do because Trump backs all of these. It's, I think, now pretty clear what the goal is, which is just make people assume all elections are under question. And if you lose faith in all elections, then you won't believe any of the results. I mean, the same thing he did with us in the news media, he's doing with election results. Don't believe any of it. He told Leslie Stahl, why do you call it the fake news? He goes, so when they write bad stories about me, people won't believe it. Mm-hmm. So why do you question all election results, even the ones that you do well in? Well, because I don't want anybody to believe it when I lose. I mean, it's pretty clear where he's headed here, and it's
working.
Where this is going, I fear that it's working.
Yeah, there was a poll out. Right?
I fear that it is.
Yeah. I just saw some poll this morning somewhere talking about trust in the media is at an all-time low.
Oh, trust in the media, definitely. Yeah, that's worked. That's worked big time.
Yeah, that's worked.
You know, staying on Trump for one second, we had the head of the Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts on yesterday, the day before, whatever. And I asked her about Trump's litigation to get back on Twitter. And she said she wanted to think about it a little bit. I asked it in the context of how does Twitter at least not give one more chance to a presidential candidate? If Trump declares, one presidential candidate has access to Twitter and another one does not. I mean, I know you're not a constitutional scholar, but as somebody who follows all this closely, there's no way Twitter can keep this guy off Twitter. Jack Dorsey can keep Trump off Twitter if he decides to run again. Is there?
Well, there's certain things he certainly can't prevent. I don't think he can prevent the Trump campaign from buying ads on Twitter, for instance. I don't think you can prevent, there's certain things you can't do there. And so I still think he can, yes, he has the right to decide if Trump can use his platform. But there is some lines. I mean, I do think you're right. I think that Dorsey wants to find, and I think Facebook, I think everybody is going to try to get to a place that says, well, he's an active candidate and we have to let an active candidate use, you got to allow an active candidate into the town square. I just think this is going to be, I agree that they're going to probably come to that conclusion. I don't know if that is the right conclusion.
Yeah. I'm looking at Marjorie.
I have a theory that Joe Biden has, The Joe Biden poll numbers started to decline sooner than we realized. It was the day the mute button was hit on Trump. Mm. The more Trump talks and uses social media, it has usually accrued to the benefit of the Democrats.
It's a very, very good point. I would like to say for people who are not watching Marjorie on Zoom like I am right now, that if Trump does declare, Marjorie's going to need an EMT by her side during every broadcast.
You know,
you should see yourself.
I guess it's because it's so clear that the impacts he's had are so deep and far-reaching and distressing. And
supported by tens of millions of
right.
people.
And as many people have said, he may be gone, at least at the moment, but Trumpism is not. But let me ask you something about Nikki Haley. I've always found her a fascinating politician. She may be, do you think she's running? And if she is running for president, what's her strategy?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's actually a candidate right now that is running the campaign that she's going to try to run, which is Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, right? He's trying to basically say, I don't like Donald Trump. I'm not a big Donald Trump guy. I'm not going to say that, though. And I want Donald Trump people to, you know, he sort of walks this line of appeasement, which is what he does, right? And, you know, if he can win, then I think there's viability to her strategy. I think there's a ceiling. We're going to find out. He has a theory of the case that he can do this that he can win over enough of these suburban voters without having to distance himself from Trump. I'm skeptical that that's going to work. But that's their theory. If he does win, then it makes me think that Nikki Haley's more viable and that strategy could work. But that to me is, you know, you're asking if it works. Ask me again after the Virginia governorship.
Well, okay, well, ask you again after that. But I'm wondering, even prior to this and other races, too, what impact you think the Texas abortion ruling, even though the Justice Department has put a temporary emergency hold on it, is going to have nationwide, because people don't want to get rid of Roe. I think the number of abortions number of women who've had abortions in America is in the millions and millions. So how does that play?
I think this is going to be a different. I actually think this is going to when the court does what it does on Mississippi, and really it is the Mississippi case that I think is going to be the defining
the 15 week
case. Yeah, 15 week. And whether they allow 15 weeks to happen by overturning Roe or by chipping away at Roe is, you know, that's the only thing we don't know, right? It's pretty clear they're going to allow it. The question is, how are they going to justify it, right? Are they going to overturn Roe or somehow say that it this doesn't overturn Roe? But I think that's the moment that you start to see the campaigns on the state for state legislatures change, because I think what this does is it puts every state legislature on notice. And I think it flips the abortion argument in a way. I don't know if it necessarily, you know, and I do think it will animate the left a little bit on judicial issues more so than they have been in the past. But I just think it is going to change the nature of state legislative races. I think abortion becomes a litmus test in a way that might jumpstart the Democrats' ability to get competitive again on that level.
Okay, you got 30 seconds. Rays or Sox?
How do you ever bet against the Rays? Now, here's the more important thing. Can you name five Rays?
I can't name one Ray.
Yeah. Name five.
You can call me Ray. What?
Yeah, I mean, there's Arena, right? You know, Randy Arena, right? I know that. I think there's a Kevin Kiermaier. I think him. It's like, who else, right? You know, get to know them, though. All they seem to do is win.
Hmm.
Yeah, and the stadium is often not full.
Pathetic. The fans are pathetic.
Yeah. Look, in defense, have you been to St. Petersburg? The stadium is not, you know, look, they need to do one of two things. Put it where people live. They live in Tampa. They don't live in St. Petersburg. Your grandparents live in St. Petersburg. Put it in actual Tampa or put it in Orlando. You know, the franchise is too good to be sitting in that dilapidated arena in St. Petersburg.
Okay. That's why Fenway's the best. Right downtown. Yeah. Hey, Chuck, thanks.
I will say this.
What?
You can't get more polar opposite than that stupid dome and Fenway.
Yeah. Talk to you next week.
Thank you so much, Chuck.
Thanks, Chuck.
Chuck Todd is moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. So, coming up. For Republicans across the country, a Trump endorsement would play well to the new base of the party. But here at home, is it a different story? We'll open the lines and ask you. Trump has endorsed Jeff Diehl. That's next, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I have to say I love this story. Former President Donald Trump may be deeply unpopular in Massachusetts in general, but that didn't stop him from getting involved in the governor's race. He's endorsed Jeff Diehl, and you may not know this. Jeff Diehl is a declared candidate for the Republican nomination. Baker hasn't announced what he's doing yet. A day after Diehl claimed, without evidence, that the 2020 presidential election was rigged. Charlie Baker, the incumbent Republican, who continues to be one of the most popular governors of the country, even more popular by far, actually, with Democrats, has shrugged off Trump's endorsement of his potential rival, saying he's, quote, not surprised for a whole bunch of reasons. Can't wait to discuss this with the governor. In any case, so we're opening the lines asking you, is a Trump endorsement in Democrat-ruled Massachusetts a kiss of death for a Republican, or will this end up being a thorn in Baker's side as his own party moves further and further and further to the right, the Massachusetts party? Well, the national party, too, than it's ever been. 877-301-8970. You know, by the way, I had Jeff Diehl shortly after he announced on television with me on Greater Boston, I don't know, a couple of months ago. He's, you know, it's sort of analogous to what Chuck Todd was saying about Haley and the guy who's running, the Republican running for governor in Virginia, is sort of, I want Trump's support, but I'm going to distance myself on some things. Like, he was not nearly as dug in terms of, I asked him about January 6th, was the election rigged, that sort of thing. Having said that, do you not love this story? I mean, it's perverse, well, but I love this story.
I mean, as Commonwealth Magazine points out, and other people pointed out, you pointed this out, you know, the Republican Party is tiny in Massachusetts. That could be because
it's 9% of registered voters, right? Yep.
As my former colleague Shelley Cohen wrote in the Boston Globe, you know, the guy that runs it is one crotchety old guy known for his political nuttiness, and it's so bad that big-time donors, the old-time Republicans, don't want to donate their money in some cases to the party. But we had a guy who was pretty nutty a few years ago. Remember we had him on the radio, Scott Lively?
Sure.
Who ran.
I think nutty is really being kind.
Well,
he was dangerous, I would argue.
And really not a nice guy at all, like Jeff Diehl, who is a nice guy. He got 36% of the Republican primary vote.
Good point.
Against Charlie Baker. So is this Commonwealth Magazine piece points out that Charlie Baker can't alienate the entire Republican Party unless you're going to get a lot of independent Democrats. You might even need independent Democrats to switch over to vote, whether or not can't be Democrats.
You mean unenrolled, Democratic-leaning people who can vote in either primary. Yeah, except for the fact that the Democratic primary is going to have at least three candidates in it. It may have Maura Healey in it. So there's going to be a lot of interest in voting in that thing, too. I have, you know, if Jeff Diehl, we've both known him for a long time, former state rep. If Jeff, and he ran for the Senate, obviously, we know a couple of years ago. If Jeff Diehl wants some advice from me, I'm going to give it right now because that shows how bipartisan I am.
Uh-huh.
Here's what he does. He obviously gleefully takes the Trump endorsement in the primary because Trump is popular in the Massachusetts Republican election, right? The day he wins the primary, beating Charlie Baker, just for purposes of this discussion, he beats Charlie Baker. He, at his victory rally, he says Biden won the election legitimately. It was not rigged. At which point, Trump trashes him, withdraws his endorsement, and Diehl has a chance of winning in the final.
Well, I don't think Diehl has a chance of winning in the final.
That was a joke, by the way. 877-301 89-70. Well, you know, by the way, you don't know where he's going to move. I mean, if you look at the electorate in this state, you might say that any Republican doesn't have a chance of winning in a final. But we've had a ton of Republican governors, most recently Governor Baker.
Right. But they've been, I mean, the closest to a conservative would have been Mitt Romney and he ran as a moderate.
So how do you know that Jeff Diehl's not going to run as a moderate?
Well, I tell you one thing. I was stunned at how well Jeff Diehl did in debates with Elizabeth Warren. He did really well.
He was good.
Because he's got the boys' regular thing. Like I said before, he's a nice guy. You like him when you meet him. He's a nice-looking guy. He's got it all going. But he does have, I think, a problem because he's going to be too associated with Donald Trump no matter what he does after the primary. But listen to this. I love this paragraph from Commonwealth magazine. It's by the staffer, otherwise I credit the writer. So here's the thumbnail version of how crazy things are with wacky Massachusetts politics. A former Republican president, Trump, deeply unpopular in the state, Massachusetts, has endorsed a former Republican state rep running for governor who has virtually no chance of being elected, but it could be a sign of trouble for the Republican incumbent, Baker, who continues to be one of the most popular governors in all of America.
So this is essentially, for those listening to the show, as you do every day, the other day, the whole show was Marjorie Egan reading Beth Tytel's column 15 times. Today, she's going to read from Commonwealth Magazine.
That's
877-3-
I'm not going to read from it anymore. I know it upsets you.
877-301-8970. By the way, let's be clear here. It is not impossible that Charlie Baker, as wildly popular as he is overall, could lose a Republican primary. I mean, the point that's really good in the Commonwealth Magazine thing is if Scott Lively, who is out of the mainstream as any Republican could possibly be, maybe not these days, but those days, could get 36% in a primary or whatever number was, you know, who knows? A Trump-backed candidate like Diehl may be able to, too. 877-301-8970. And I know this is perverse because we say so many times we're sick of talking about Trump. If someone can analyze me and say, why is it that I am so excited by the story that Trump is involved in Massachusetts politics? Why do you think that is, Marjorie? Why don't you ask Commonwealth Magazine what they think?
Well, because one of the great problems, Jim, is Donald Trump is fun to talk about and fun to hear about.
He is.
That's why he drives ratings even out of office. That's why we're talking about him so much, because he's sort of an irresistible. He's like a train wreck. You know, you have to stop the car, or the car crash. You have to stop the car, look at the car crash. I mean, what are you looking for? You're looking for bloody bodies? You're looking for death and destruction? I don't know, but we do it. And I think he's similar to that kind of thing. And it's less depressing than thinking about the mess we're in now, where we can't seem to get anywhere with infrastructure we just did have this delay on the defaulting on our debt, but it's pretty depressing when you think about the straits we're in and our inability to act.
Can I add one more Trump thing to this discussion before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970? It's essentially a Trump half hour if you want to vent or praise him, whatever you want to do. If you wanted something as bad as Mike Pence and Nikki Haley want the presidency, imagine your dream job or your dream something and said the only way you can get it is to totally swallow your principles and humiliate yourself by doing a 180 from where you've been. I'm talking about Mike Pence, who they were trying to kill on January 6th, saying the media has blown January 6th out of proportion, and Nikki Haley, who was trashing Trump's allegations about the election not too long ago, now practically, you know, praying at the altar of Donald Trump. Is there anything that would cause you to engage in that kind of behavior of self-humiliation? Is there anything?
Well, I hope not. I mean, it is pretty humiliating, but it doesn't seem to matter anymore because we live in one world, and I think a lot of Republicans live in another world.
They do.
And their world, unfortunately for them, is pretty far from the actual world.
Let's talk to Ann in Lincoln. You're first on Boston Public Radio. The number is 877-301-8970. Hi, Ann.
Oh, hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I could possibly vote for Charlie Baker again. I don't know about the other guy, but actually, I did not vote for Charlie Baker before because of the fact that our national politics is in such a crisis with what's happened to the Republican Party. I don't think it's possible for any Democrat who's really thinking this out to elect a Republican governor in this state with the possibility of that governor appointing a senator should one of our 70-plus-year-old senators not be able to fulfill their term. It's just too critical that we keep Democrats in the Senate. And I don't think Charlie Baker would appoint a Democrat
Well, of course he wouldn't. By the way, just so you know, and I'm sure you know this, Ann, Baker is wildly popular with Democrats in Massachusetts. I mean, wildly popular, not popular. Like, wildly popular. You know that.
I do, and I could vote for him, but I can't because of this reason.
Got it.
I cannot let him have the possibility, and I think all the Democrats here ought to wake up to this. It's just too critical in our national Senate at this point.
And thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970 is our phone number.
You know, there was a big brouhaha. Remember when Jim Lyons, who's the head of the party, refused to condemn these homophobic slurs of this Republican State Committee member?
Martell.
Yes.
Deb Martell.
And he said that giving in to that would be giving in to cancel culture. That was
Didn't
his...
he say it wasn't her line? She was sickened by the fact that there is a gay guy
that
who's got kids,
children, yeah,
who is running against Jim McGovern in McGovern's. I mean, you know, it's pathetic.
And Shelley talked about the frustration of some of these big time Republicans in Massachusetts that are so frustrated by the likes of Jim Lyons and his antics that they have said they're no longer giving them any money. But they did offer to ransom to raise $1 million to, as they put it, should the state committee come to its senses and take appropriate action to restore the Massachusetts Republican Party's reputation, which they argue is really gone down the
tattered
tubes.
So, you know what the other thing that, speaking of Trump, that, as you know, I am obsessed with, and you are, I think, the first person in America who called him unhinged. It was about a second and
unhinged.
A half after he declared his candidacy. Did you hear him in Georgia the other night trashing the pro-Trump Republican governor Kemp of Georgia, and saying
Stacey
Georgia
Abrams,
would be better off if Stacey Abrams, who has utter contempt for Trump, needless to say, was the governor of Georgia. I mean, it is just there's a problem in that. There's a problem there. Diane in Fairhaven, welcome to the show, Diane.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I have voted for Baker in the past two elections, much to the chagrin of the Democratic committee that I'm on in my town. And part of that reason to me, a huge part actually, is that I have served twice on the bargaining team with the Governor's Council with my PCA union, 1199 SEIU.
Oh.
And he's been more than fair and generous with us. As a matter of fact, he just extended our pandemic pay that's close to $18 an hour until April of 2022. So,
wow.
Yes, and we are the highest paid. We always have been, but now we're even more highly paid than other PCAs in the country. So I have to give him his due for that. However, I agree with your previous caller. It's very critical. I'm going to vote Democrat this year. And not that I don't appreciate what he's done, especially for my union. So anyway, that's
and
my
why, And on. Why are you going to Democrat this year?
Because it's we need to have as many Democrats in office as we can.
Yeah.
And right now, and I think that, and I don't believe Baker is a Trump supporter. But
No. He is not a Trump supporter.
Yeah.
He is not a Trump supporter.
Right. Yeah. So I got to give him his due for that too. So
Diane, thanks. Yeah, it's always good. We appreciate it. It's always good to talk to you. So here's what I would do. If I were an unenrolled person who is hell-bent on electing Democrats, like the first two callers are today, I would become unenrolled, which, by the way, for those who don't know, is by far the largest registration category in Massachusetts. Unenrolled, it's bigger than Democrats. Democrats far bigger than Republicans. I would vote. You ready for this, Marjorie?
Yep.
I would vote in the Republican primary for Jeff Diehl, in the hopes that Jeff Diehl beats a very popular Charlie Baker, and then the likelihood of the Democrat, whoever he or she ends up being, winning the final is dramatically increased. I think we would all agree the Democrat beating Diehl is more likely than a Democrat beating Charlie Baker. Is that correct? That's called strategic voting.
I think Moore Healey would give him a run for his money.
No, that wasn't my point. My point was it is whoever the Democrat is more likely to beat Jeff Diehl than he or she is to beat Charlie Baker. They may beat Charlie Baker. I don't know. But Baker is going to do far better in a final than Jeff Diehl is. That was my point.
I would say he would do far better in a final than Jeff Diehl. Although, as I said before, you know, I think when you listen to him, you see him, he does not sound like, you know, a political nuttiness or the crotchetiness that you have in the Republican Party in Massachusetts, the state party. Shelley Cohen points out in her piece, do you know the GOP registration in Suffolk County is only 5%?
I didn't. Well, it's only 9% national, statewide, so it's not surprising, is it?
I don't know.
Suffolk County's Boston, essentially. I know it's Winthrop, et cetera, but it's essentially Boston. Boston is an overwhelmingly Democratic city. I mean, that is what it is, isn't it?
877-301-8970. Let's go to Carol in Sandwich. Hi, Carol.
Hello, Carol.
Hi there. I have mostly it's just an observation, but several years ago, I noticed that what happens in Massachusetts is the Democrats have absolutely the best ideas, and I think that's true nationally, too. But we Democrats cannot execute our way out of a paper bag. We just can't get out of our own way, as opposed to the Republicans who have lousy ideas, but they can execute anything.
That's a great point. Great point.
The legislature and let Baker have the governorship. I think he's a fair guy and he's doing a good job for Republicans. So, anyway, that's my point.
Well, you know, the thesis, which is not directly your point, Carol, but thank you for the call, is the reason we keep electing so many Republican governors. It may be because people think well of them personally as leaders. That's one thing. The other thing is most people don't like the notion of having all the power in a particular state or government in the hands of one party. And that's some sort of a check, even though obviously Charlie Baker is nowhere near a right-wing Republican. Carol, thank you for your call. 877-301-8970. And by the way, in fairness to the National Dems, while I think Carol's point generally is true, the battle over these two infrastructure bills is not over. I mean, who knows what the end game is going to be, but it's possible that they go from unable to do anything to maybe the biggest victory in decades in terms of real progress in this country.
Excuse me.
Bless you, Marjorie. We got to take
you
a break, though. 877-301-8970 is our phone number.
Okay. We are talking about Trump, that is former President Trump, reinserting himself into politics with an endorsement of Republican gubernatorial candidate Jeff Diehl, asking how this bodes for the Republican Party in Massachusetts and the governor's race ahead. The conversation continues on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're talking about the fact that Donald Trump has endorsed a candidate in the race for governor. Jeff Diehl, former state rep, ran obviously for the U.S. Senate a couple of years ago. He is an announced candidate for the Republican nomination. He has the endorsement of Charlie Baker. We wanted to get your reaction to that endorsement. And Charlie Baker has not yet decided. What's the impact in the preliminary? What's the impact in the final? You know, I'm just looking at Marjorie. We'll get back to your calls in a second. I'm just looking at Marjorie. You got to mute your Zoom if you can, please. I'm just looking at the interview that I did with Jeff Diehl, the write up of the interview on the WGBH.org website. And this is the point that I was trying to make. Jeff Diehl, like other Republicans who want to move into higher office, again, whether it's Haley, the guy whose name I can't remember from Virginia, or Diehl, I don't think it was a stolen election, Diehl said, on and on like that. Meaning he is going to try to have it both ways, which I would do if I was a Republican, probably too, is you try not to totally alienate Trump because he's very powerful in the Republican base. At the same time, you try to create a little distance so people don't think you're totally out of your mind. You know what I mean? I'm serious. I mean, 877-301-8970.
I just need to point out the crazy things that the former president says that aren't true about Massachusetts. For one thing, he says crime has gone through the roof in Massachusetts under Charlie Baker, even though crime has gone down considerably and it continues to go down under Massachusetts. He just gets up there and lies. And he talks about how, you know, that Jeff Deal's in favor of our independent energy system, which, of course, is the reason that we're having all these terrible climate disasters because of that independent energy system. But he just says these things, and it just doesn't matter. Just gets up there and just lies.
It's Marjorie, really, I incredible. Say it for the 10th time. After the Arizona fake audit,
I know,
said that Joe Biden won by, what, 300 more votes than he actually won by, Trump the following Saturday, I think it was in Georgia, saying the Arizona audit proved my point that the election was rigged and we won. I mean, by the way, some people think that's just being a pathological lawyer, a liar. As I've said 1,000 times, I think there is a real question about the, well, let me quote Nancy Pelosi to General Milley in that phone call. Crazy. I know that's not a term of art. I know it offends some people. That's how Pelosi described Donald Trump. Milley agreed. And it's really hard to disagree, isn't it?
We should have all listened to Rex Tillerson early on in the administration, the guy that used to run Exxon, who called him a moron. But you know something?
He was in the administration, right? In the administration,
yes.
Right?
He was. He was his secretary. What was he? Secretary of State? I think
so.
Or
yeah.
Yeah, Rex Tillerson, because he looked the part. That was the reason Trump gave him the job. You know, he looked good. He wanted a central casting kind of administration. But the thing is, people have said that over and over again about Donald Trump. When you read anything, his niece, who knows him well since childhood, said it. I mean, people that are close to him that are not themselves deranged realize that he's deranged. Well, it's true. I mean, look at the people this former press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, that is just coming out of the White House, dumping all over him and all over Melania. Craig from Jamaica Plain, thank you for calling.
Hi, Marjorie. Jim.
Hi, you got to turn the radio down. Welcome.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought the radio was then. I turned it off. Are you hearing something else?
We did, but it's fine now. Go ahead.
Okay, good. So first of all, you know, Donald Trump is dumb like a fox. And if you think he's crazy, that's just his whole act. I lived for years in New York before Donald Trump was anything but just a real estate investor. And he hasn't changed. There's nothing about him that's changed. He's just gotten a bigger platform. He is an inveterate liar who's learned that lying works.
Yeah.
So that's not going to change. And you know, when people say, I can't believe he says this, you know, for example, the Arizona result, the mere fact that he says it is enough for a percentage of the population to believe him. And that won't change either.
Well, you know where that comes from, Craig? Craig, I lived in New York for a piece of Trump, too, and I respectfully disagree with your analysis. I agree that he was a liar then and a liar now. I think if you watch video of Donald Trump 15 years ago and you see him today, there has been a serious disintegration of something up there. That's number one. But two, the historical thing, which I'm sure you know, Craig, we've mentioned on the show before, this is all from him learning at the knee of one of the most despicable characters of the last century, Roy Cohn, who obviously we know from the McCarthy hearings, but we also know he became the lawyer for the Trump family. And the one of the great stories is they lose this horrible housing discrimination case around discriminating against black, I think it was tenants, if I remember correctly. Cohn says to him, just go out there and tell the press we won and say it relentlessly, and he did. And that's essentially what his MO has been ever since. It just, I think then he was a sane liar, and I'm not sure the first half
I don't know
is right now.
Was,
Craig, thanks for
calling.
I don't
know if he was ever sane. I mean, you read that the niece's book, the cruelty was there from when he was
That's a good point.
And the narcissistic personality disorder, which so many people have talked about, was there since he was a child. And the whole family, his father was unbelievably cruel. And he was unbelievably cruel to the brother that died of alcoholism. I mean, it's really,
you're right.
You know, it just goes to show that you can be rich, but you don't have... You don't have everything because the family was just a mess. Lee from Action.
By the way, before you do that, Marjorie has computer problems, so she can't read the email today. She's very distraught.
I can,
which I rarely do. But John writes, getting back to the what was the name of the guy you just mentioned? Was the Secretary of State for a brief period of time?
Tillerson.
He didn't just call him a moron, Marjorie. He called him an effing moron.
He did.
So that to correct the record, John, the emailer, is right on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But you know, the other thing. I mean, we've been hearing these Facebook hearings for 2 days up on Capitol Hill. Before mm-hmm. that, we saw the very credible former Facebook employee on 60 Minutes. There is this, like I said, this alternative universe that people are in, that they're taking horse medicine for COVID. They don't think they need to get a vaccine. They think Trump
taking
is great.
Horse
well, you know,
no, you're
that's
right.
That's what's happening.
You're right.
I mean, the story about the person that threatened violence against the doctor when the physician refused to prescribe the horse medicine to the person. I mean, it's like half the country has taken leave of planet Earth.
I agree.
And I think it's a lot to do. Less to do with anyone's, it has to do with the media, where they get their news.
What's a great line? I know we don't quote Woody Allen anymore, but I can't help myself. When he's in the car with, what's his name? And he says, I'm sorry, Dwayne, I have to return to planet Earth.
That's right, I stole it.
Christopher Walken. You know, John, is there anything you don't know, John? You're incredible. By the way, I'm having fun reading the email, which I never do because that's Marjorie.
Oh,
doesn't
good.
Let me.
Well, you can read it. I'll go to Lee and Acton. Hi, Lee
so
and
wait,
Acton.
Wait, before, I'm going to read this one before we go to Lee and Acton.
Oh, okay.
So this the subject of this one is if Trump wins the presidency or takes over Congress, mm-hmm. Anne has a question, I think, for you, Marjorie.
What?
Does Bermuda take U.S. refugees? And I think... It's a question our staff will research, and we'll get back to you in the morning.
I prefer the Bahamas, actually. I think the weather can be a little iffy in Bermuda. You know, it's
isn't
more...
the Bahamas part of the United States, though?
I don't
think Bermuda is part of the UK. I don't know.
All I know is that the weather's supposedly better in the Bahamas. On the other hand, the Bahamas may not be there that much longer, or Bermuda might not be there that much longer either at the rate we're going.
Do you know one of my college roommates owns 99 islands in the Bahamas, the one that owns the Old Town Trolley?
Really?
99 islands in the
Bahamas. Maybe you should sell a few.
Bahamas.
Because things are not looking good for the islands around the Bahamas.
Lee Acton.
From Acton. Hi,
hey,
Lee.
What's up?
Hi. I'm a born and bred Southerner from North Carolina, and I am so happy to be in Massachusetts. Been here for 6 years because there's so many like-minded people up here. We've done a good job during the pandemic, and I have to bite my tongue every time I talk to my friends in the South.
You know, I have a good friend of mine, Lee, who's temporarily, she's lucky enough to be able to retire. She's temporarily living in Florida, you know, for a certain part of the year. And she said the day before the insurrection at the Capitol, her neighbor came over and she thought he was a nice guy. You know, it helped her get workmen at the house and blah, cookouts and all that kind of thing. And he comes over and he says, is anything I can do for you tomorrow? And she says, what's tomorrow? And he says, well, it's the storming of the Capitol, and Q is going to reveal who all the bad people are, and Donald Trump is going to take control, and he's going to execute them all right there in the steps of the Capitol. And my friend's looking at this guy and thinking, okay, he's a QAnon. He's one of these people. And she said, you never know. You'd think he was a normal person.
Exactly.
And you're surrounded by them. So what is it because of the – what is it in North Carolina? Is it the media? Is it Facebook? Is it Fox News? Is it these TV stations that are all run by that same right-wing Sinclair Broadcasting?
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah, it's all of that. I lived in South Carolina, too, for 25 years. So it's all of that. And they've just been so nonchalant about the pandemic and everything. And, you know, well, maybe a vaccine, you know, and half my friends don't have vaccines. And it's just I feel safer up here. I'm more comfortable. I just feel like people up here in New England do things the right way. They follow the rules, and I just like it. And a lot of your callers have made good points about the politics and so forth in Massachusetts. But like I said, I'm almost at a point that I don't care because I just like things up here so much.
Lee, we are really happy
except
to have
snow.
You. Carolina's
snow,
loss,
that's right.
Our gain. Lee, thank you. Now,
Lee,
Marjorie,
thank you very much. That was a great call.
Can I tell you, the reason you're happy, so happy during every damn show is because you get to read the email. This is like
email's
a whole
great.
New experience.
It's wonderful.
So Karen, for example, corrects me, which I'm fine with, and says the Bahamas is an independent country. I might have been thinking of the Virgin Islands. I actually wasn't. I was just incorrectly describing. However, this really says everything about our audience, which obviously you understand better than I do.
Yeah.
What do you think is by far the most common theme in the most emails? By far, there's not even a close second during this segment. Go ahead.
I have no idea. You tell me.
That he didn't say moron, that he said effing moron. Oh. I would say there are about 20 emails This is what our people care about.
We love
about,
our listeners.
That
we
Rex
love
Tillerson
our listeners.
Called him an effing moron, not a moron. Get your story right, Marjorie and Jim. Kevin in a car, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Keep those emails coming. I'm having a blast. Go ahead. Hi.
Hey, guys. Before I go off on my tirade, I want to let you know what mountain I'm shouting from. Nancy Pelosi is too far right for me. And that's
okay.
What I'm going to say.
Okay. Okay.
Charlie Baker is as close to a rhino as you could possibly get. He's leading the charge on wages. He's leading the charge on clean energy. And I think everybody who is super concerned about him putting a too conservative senator in place is letter obsessed. I don't think that is a valid concern.
Why?
You mean you think he'd have a much more moderate, middle-of-the-road, Ed Brooke-type Republican senator? Is that what you're saying?
He would either put a moderate or a straight-up rhino who isn't going to play the game.
Hey, Kevin, with all due respect, you're totally missing something. The Senate is 50-50. If this were to happen, and by the way, this was only a caller who said earlier, if obviously we wish good health to our senators. They're saying they're in their 70s. You never know what's going to happen. This is a 50-50 Senate. You could appoint the most liberal Republican to replace Warren or Markey, and Mitch McConnell is the leader of the United States Senate. That is an earthquake, a political earthquake of epic proportions. It's not. Maybe it wouldn't matter if it was 57-43 or 43-57, but control of the Senate right now is by one vote, and who knows what's going to happen in 2022. So I think that was the point that was being made by the caller, you know?
Of course, control of the Senate,
Kevin,
seems
also,
to be...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Kevin.
It's also possible that he would put in an independent.
Yeah.
It's not, I understand the concern. I don't think that it's as much of a fire as, or I don't think there's even smoke at that point, never with Baker, never mind the fire.
I appreciate your opinion, Kevin. By the way, we will ask Charlie Baker, even though it's a tough topic to bring up because these are two healthy senators. Maybe we won't bring it up with Charlie Baker.
Okay, well, why don't you keep reading the emails, Jim, and let me know.
Let me tell you, how did I miss this for 20 years?
You just said, Marjorie, you do it. You do it.
I didn't say, by the way, that is not true.
You do it.
Didn't say that.
Get me a cup of coffee after that.
Have I ever done that? Ever?
No, I'm only
teasing
you.
Thank you.
I'm only teasing you. Okay.
Oh my
Coming
God.
Up.
I'm doomed.
Andrew Cabral joins us up next on this week's edition of Law and Order. She's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral joins us with her take on whether the Justice Department ought to be doing more to hold police departments accountable when it comes to policing themselves. She'll also speak to the guilty plea this week by a former Boston Police Union president. That's the latest in the BPD's unfolding overtime scandal. And we'll talk about Congress getting involved in the marijuana business, something she knows more than a little bit about.
Harvard University's Dan Carpenter just published a terrific piece in the New York Times asking the question, why are COVID vaccines for kids taking so long? Well, he answered the question, too. We'll get his take and also how everything has changed, or maybe not, with this morning's news of Pfizer's request to the FDA to approve the shot for kids 5 to 11 years old. Plus, are we barreling toward an egg shortage in Massachusetts? And what would that mean for daily Dunkin' Donut breakfast runs? Corby Cummer's got you covered. All that and more ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. So George Floyd's murder by Minneapolis police officer Chauvin, former officer, I should say, sparked massive nationwide protests against racism, against police violence. Congress, however, couldn't get its act together. Bipartisan talks to implement reforms in Floyd's name failed to produce any legislation. It was announced, I think, like maybe 10 days ago. But the Biden administration and the Justice Department could still tackle some abusive police practices on their own. They couldn't deal with everything. They could deal with plenty. And a recent editorial in the Boston Globe argues they must be tougher on law enforcement. Former Secretary of Public Safety Andrew Cabral is on the line to discuss this and more for this week's edition of Law and Order. Andrea is the former Suffolk County Sheriff, the former State Secretary of Public Safety, and she is now the CEO of Ascend. Welcome, Andrea.
Hello, Jim, and hello, Marjorie.
Hey there.
Hello, Andrea Cabral. Well, you don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but it does seem that there are many police departments beyond the problems with the racism and the police brutality that have corruption issues. We now have Thomas Nee, the former head of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, pleading guilty to an overtime fraud scandal. He's the 15th Boston police officer to be charged. We have one in New York, too. I'll get to that. But, well, I may as well mention it right now. Actually, they had an FBI raid on this union head down, the sergeant who used to be head of the Sergeant's Benevolent Association union there. Has just had an FBI raid at his house, and he's alleged to have dealt in some very nefarious tactics down there with the union. He denies it. But he's been a tough guy, anti-reform. He's all over Fox News and Newsmax. In one of those appearances, he had a QAnon mug in front of him. His name is, what is his name?
Mullins.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you very much. So these are two major police departments, and not to mention our own state police department. I don't know. It's like I said, I shouldn't paint with too broad a brush, but we do seem to have some big-time police departments with big-time dishonesty problems.
Well, I think to the point of the Globe editorial, the Justice Department could be tougher on a lot more, not just law enforcement, but it could take a more aggressive stance on any one of a number of things that are consonant with its mission, including holding the insurrectionists more accountable and doing a deeper dive into what led to that. But I think the point of the editorial is well taken, that they do have to be tougher on law enforcement. It really puzzles me the level of reticence that we see with doing this. I mean, there are any one of a number of Trump-era rollbacks that went fundamentally to changing the mission of the DOJ and turning it into his own, personal enforcement organization versus working on behalf of the people. There are a number of things that Trump did that could simply be reversed with, the flick of a switch or the stroke of a pen that still haven't done. And the editorial, does point out that those things could be done, by the president pretty easily. And
like what? Can you give us an example or two, Andrea, if you would?
Sure. So, they made sort of a twofold argument. One, that the federal government is still sort of lagging behind. So the administration will make an announcement that they're going to ban chokeholds and no-knock warrants. That's great, but that really just catches them up to a lot of local police department rules that have long been adopted. And the fact that he could reverse pretty easily, that he has reversed the consent decrees, but he could certainly use,
financial leverage is one of the things
right.
they say in these federal
exactly.
funds and how important they are to these police departments,
exactly.
right? Yeah.
So they all sort of depend upon, in fact, there's very few state law enforcement agencies or local law enforcement agencies that don't depend on federal funding. So the two aspects were making sure that federal funds are held in abeyance if there are these continued violations of policy and uses of excessive force, and holding their feet to the fire with regard to that. But also making sure that in withholding those funds from the police department, that there's a data collection, bringing back the science board. So the policy used to be driven by the data. So the Trump did away with the science board, which was actually stepping up data collection, because it's very sporadic, to the FBI and to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and that was what federal policy flowed from. All you have to do is reinstate that board. So you're not just withholding money on an anecdotal basis when there are instances of use of excessive force. The other part was to focus less on larger departments, and those are the ones that garner a lot of attention, and focus more on mid-sized departments where there are violations that are, in some cases, even more serious and even more systemic. But this is really about changing culture. So that is what the reticence against reform is, and changing the culture goes to what Marjorie mentioned with Tommy Knee and Mullins in New York. It is a culture and an acceptance of things that are unacceptable, up to and including illegal, within police departments. It silences the good people who don't want those things to happen, and it allows the bad stuff to proliferate. And that's really why the Justice Department needs to show leadership on reform.
You know, I have to say, I have not been wildly impressed by Merrick Garland's tenure so far as Attorney General. I mean, the most dramatic thing, which I know will provoke you, Andrew Cabral, is there are people like Lawrence Tribe, who's a pretty smart guy, formerly of Harvard Law School and constitutional scholar, who, by the way, was Merrick Garland's professor at Harvard, in addition to many other prominent people like the Obamas, who thinks there's a case to be made, a criminal case to be made against Donald Trump. And the conventional wisdom from analysts is if it's not being made, and we don't know if there is a grand jury, I think we talked to you about this last week, is because he doesn't want the department to seem too political. That problem, even though I don't agree with it, would not obtain here. Why would he not be as aggressive as one can possibly be with rogue police departments? I mean, it is so fits the Biden constituency and the Biden agenda. Why so reluctant to be bold here? I just don't get it.
I don't understand it either. It's an excellent, excellent question. It's the same one that I have. I don't know what
the downside is,
particularly given the Department of Justice's mission. This is their fundamental mission. And it is just that it has gotten so far away from that in recent years that the way back is longer. But it doesn't mean that it's impossible to get there. And as I said, some of these things can be done reversed very, very easily to put it back on track. And I don't know if it's because, as a judge, Merrick Garland is a study in temperance.
Exactly.
That's a very good point.
Exactly.
It's not what's called for.
To me, he's the wrong guy on the job. I mean, he might have been a great justice on the Supreme Court. I know he's got a great record. But it seems there's an old school, you know, dot all the T's, dot all the I's, rather, cross all the T's thing about him, the temperance, the measuredness, that maybe he's just not the rough and tumble person that might be better in this particular moment.
I think that's possible. And I think that needs to be corrected really, really quickly. This idea that police reform stalled out because there couldn't be bipartisan compromise. I mean, is there anybody who's been watching any of this that ever thought that there would be bipartisan compromise?
Right.
The GOP could not be clearer. We will not agree to anything you want to do. We will slow walk everything you want to do. This is about the midterms and us getting back into power, so we never have to listen to you again. How much clearer could they be? So anybody, especially the Joe Manchins of the world, who want to, fill our ears with this rhetoric around how important it is for bipartisanship, that is absolute nonsense. And I'm waiting and waiting and waiting and certainly losing patience with Democrats thinking that that should even be a topic of conversation. If your opponent tells you, I will not, no matter what you do, continuing to pretend that at some point they're going to come around is insane.
You know, Andrea, in the last segment, we were talking about former President Trump endorsing Jeff Deal at the Republican race for governor. And a caller called and said, you know, I'm a Democrat. Democrats have a lot of good ideas, but they can't ever seem to get any of them through whereas Republicans have a lot of bad ideas and they get them all through. And you can't help thinking, it's this thing we've said a million times. The Republicans play hardball and the Democrats are supposed to follow all the rules. I mean,
yeah, it's the way it works with bullies. If you don't recognize who's standing in front of you demanding your lunch money is going to get taken every single day.
We're talking to Andrea.
I bet
Trabell.
Nobody ever stole your lunch money, Andrea.
No. As a matter of fact, they didn't. But I actually didn't. I was lucky enough to go to school with not very many bullies, as I look back on it.
Good.
I don't know why that was, but there weren't very many.
Marjorie.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral. Okay, let's move. We've talked a lot about the horrors that have gone on at Rikers Island. There was that young man, what's his name again, Jim, that was...
Khalif Browder,
yeah, forgive me for forgetting his name. Young man was in prison for stealing a backpack, which he claimed he never stole. Spent 3 years in Rikers Island, 16 years old, maintaining his innocence. Talk about not getting a fast disposition of his case. Ended up so damaged, spent so much of it in solitary confinement and a bunch of other horrors, was so psychologically damaged, he got out of prison and he killed himself. Now you have a story by Katrina Vandenhoevel, who is longtime editor of The Nation, talking about a gentleman in a wheelchair with a lot of bad problems. He came into this intake cell for 10 days, not enough adequate food, not enough medication, lawyers begging for an early release. The guy has an asthma attack and contracted COVID and died before he even could get back to court. So you just, her piece echoes what other people have said, that they need, that the state of New York needs to close Rikers Island. What do you think?
Well, the person that she profiles is named Isabdul Karim, I think the last name
yep.
is,
yep.
or maybe Karim, the last name is pronounced. And he was in for a nonviolent parole violation. So a
yeah.
nonviolent parole violation can be something like not keeping an address or reporting that address to the parole board, losing a job and not reporting that you've lost the job. If there's a prohibition against, you know, drinking or drugs, maybe having a test that comes back positive for one or the other. But it's a nonviolent parole violation, and he was in an intake cell. Now, intake cells are transitional cells. They're only until you're supposed to be processed into the main of the jail. He was in an intake cell for 10 days without that adequate access to food or medication, and he is in a wheelchair. And the fact that he, was held for that long, got COVID and died before his lawyers, who were asking for an early release, could get to court, is horrific. I don't understand why Rikers Island and any other place like it, it is not and has not been, as far as I know, although there probably have been a lot of individual lawsuits, the subject of a class action civil rights lawsuit based on the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. There are 6,000 people detained at Rikers Island. There's inadequate food, inadequate water, inadequate toilets, showers. People, we've seen the quality of the water inside the place. Access to lawyers is limited. Access to doctors is limited. They have call-outs. It's a horrific place to work. So people don't, the people who are supposed to work there, they have tons of call-outs all of the time. I think I read recently at one point, they may have actually had detainees doing some of the work of the corrections officers because they didn't have enough corrections officers to keep, and it may have been some administrative work, but they didn't have enough staff to do it. And I don't understand why these stories have been going on for 50 years. It was an incredibly bloody riot 50 years ago protesting the conditions at Rikers Island. And I just don't understand why it's not the subject of a class action lawsuit at this point. That's a civil rights, that's civil rights based and Eighth Amendment based.
My understanding is also of the 6,000 people held there, the vast majority are pretrial. I mean, they haven't even been convicted.
Right.
And they're spending time there under horrible conditions. And which made whatever happened to this movement, I'm sure we talked to you about it in the past, that bail should be, that if if a person is not a threat, I'm not talking about super violent kinds of people accused of seriously violent crimes, that that poor people not be held just because they can't meet bail. I mean, my sense of Rikers Island is if that were the methodology, virtually none of these people would be there and we wouldn't even be having these issues. They'd be out awaiting trial, right?
Right. I mean, and if you – so that's been the back and forth on bail because there are conditions other than the likelihood of return to court that a judge can use in setting bail, and among them, you know, very legitimately, the seriousness of right. the crime that's charged and the likelihood of significant incarceration, including any pending cases, at the time the person's arraigned on the new offense. But yes, the move to eliminate excessive bail or bail conditions altogether is definitely a positive way to sort of get at this. I think they're seeing a shift in New York from Cuomo to Hochul, who was the lieutenant governor and who is now the governor of New York. She has certainly put the sort of the elimination of bail as part of her platform. But no, she hasn't put the elimination of bail as part of her platform. I think she's doing something with the courts to speed up the hearings. But that's only a part of it, and I think the story suggests that she should be moving more aggressively on the elimination of bail, because merely making sure that people get before the court more quickly doesn't really do anything. The court can always continue the case
exactly.
and continue it endlessly. So you really need to figure out, and what you the other thing you never see is you never see the drill down. You've got 6,000 people there. Where are the numbers on how many people are there for nonviolent offenses? How many people are there for probation violations or parole violations versus serious people accused of serious crimes, violent crimes? Because you could decrease the population just with that analysis and some action on that analysis. So it's just gobsmacking that Rikers is allowed to, and places like it are still allowed to function.
You know, Andrea, unless one has a political agenda to pretend you're for, you know, you're anti-crime and law and order, so you have to be as tough as possible, regardless of policy, what argument is there for keeping nonviolent, I was going to say offenders, you don't know that they're offenders yet, people accused of nonviolent crimes under lock and key because they can't make bail? I can't even make the argument. What is the argument?
I don't think that there actually is an argument for it. I think that it is for legislators and for a governor, it is a political decision, and people in jail are not a constituency.
And so it is
always about spending money, right? So if you or committing resources, because you can't, no governor, no elected official is going to say this. We're just going to the doors are just going to swing wide, and people are going to walk out through the front door. That's not an excuse for not having a strategy and being able to do this. But this is not one of those. Look at how long the fact that we've been making this argument for so long. The fact that there was a riot 50 years ago at Rikers over the exact same thing tells you that there is no downside politically to ignoring it. That's really where it's not about an argument for keeping them in. It's that there's no political downside for doing nothing.
You know, in this story by one of the TV stations in New York, it was talking about how they analyzed the city data, and they said despite these bail reform laws, judges who have control over people that might be sent to Rikers continue to set bail in more cases and at higher rates
yep.
than before the pandemic, and that people are staying in jail for more than a year, awaiting their first trial, 1,500 people, according to them. I mean, it's just the court system is so overrun generally, but this is just
well. Can
insane.
I add one thing to this discussion, too? Virtually every single person at Rikers, if they don't die there, is going to get out. And so even if you don't have any compassion for fellow human beings who've made mistakes, in some cases serious mistakes, even if you don't care about the financial savings and your tax dollars and not having these people incarcerated, the more they're in jail, the more likely it is, and you know this to be true, of being from the criminal justice system, Andrea, when they do get out, the more likely is that they become recidivists, that they are a problem in society. So every single argument, not just progressive law reformers, every single argument for treating bail differently so that we don't pack our prisons to the gills and essentially end up with angrier people than they were when they went in, suggests that reform is good policy, whether you're on the right or the left. And the fact that we're so far behind is just, it's pathetic. It's really...
Well, the data definitely bears that out. To your point, the data bears that out. But keep in mind, you know, they don't call it a system for nothing. And to really get at it, like Margie pointed out, the judges are still, you know, seem to be setting bails. You know, they're ahead of pace for setting
right.
bails. There's also the issue of over-arresting and overcharging. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that system doesn't get
yeah.
full on its own, right? So it is from the point of reasonable suspicion and probable cause straight through, ultimately, conviction and incarceration. That is what the system is comprised of. And in each, you know, touch point in that system, there is the complacency of routine, as banal as that sounds, the complacency of routine being creatures of habit, and it's churning. It's a system that just continues to churn. Now, there's clear progress in some states with specialized courts, and you know, the population here in the houses of correction has gone way, way, way down, and those are the fruits of reentry programs and judges focusing on not you know, holding people on bail as frequently or incarcerating them as frequently.
And charging policy like Rachel Rollins, by the way, which
right, exactly
like
right.
Tom Cotton don't like, obviously, yeah.
Right. So it has to be all hands on deck in all aspects of the system. And because, you know, those systems are led by elected leaders who live in 4 and, you know, if they're lucky, 6-year increments, but 2, 4, and 6-year increments, you know, ideology can change, and policy always seems to stay the same.
Andrew, oh, well, as we all sigh. Andrea, it's good to talk to you, as always.
Yeah, this is always, like I say, this is, you know, the highlight of my day to talk about such uplifting topics.
That's beautiful. Ours, too. So we're on the same page. Thank you,
Connie. I'm sorry. Next time we should mention, we're working the fall foliage, Andrea. We'll see if we can...
That would be great.
Or a good pet story if we
yeah,
have one.
Crime among the falling leaves or something like that.
See you, Andrew Cabral. Thanks.
Take care.
Thank
Bye.
You. Andrew Cabral is the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. She's now the CEO of Ascend, and we thank her again for coming, even though I know it's tough stuff. Anyway, coming up, is it a school vaccine mandate if you're still allowed to attend school unvaccinated? Stay tuned for Paul Revel. He'll weigh in on that and other education issues. He's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Cambridge Public Schools has become the largest school district in the state so far to take steps to mandate COVID vaccines for students. But the so-called mandate only requires that students over the age of 12 get the vaccine in order to participate in extracurricular events like sports or social events. Unvaccinated kids can still attend class. Joining us online to talk about vaccine mandates for public school and more is Paul Revel. Paul's a former Secretary of Education and professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book is co-authored with Lynn Sachs. It's called Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, a Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Hey there, Paul Revel.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi.
Sun is out.
The sun is out.
Well,
that's
we're
right.
in, so that's
right.
good.
So, yeah. Paul Revel, You're here at Vaccine Mandate Central here, of course, the Boston Public Radio show. And I was really excited to see the story in the Globe yesterday that Cambridge School Committee had okayed a vaccine mandate for eligible students. Apparently, it's only the second, at least according to the Globe, the second big school system in the state after the Amherst system up there. But then I read the story, and even though they're saying kids can't play sports if they're not vaccinated, they can't go to school-sponsored social events, clubs, that kind of thing. They're not saying you can't come to school. They're basically saying we have a mandate, but there's no mandate. So I don't really know what they're doing over there at Cambridge.
Well, everybody's dancing around the challenging issues with this. One of the challenging issues is what kind of loopholes are you going to allow? Are there medical reasons? If so, what are they? For not getting vaccinated? Are there religious reasons? A lot of people are pressing the limits of that definition. CDC recently came out with some guidance which suggested that local officials could overrule some of these exemptions if they thought it was in the public health interest to do so. But I take it, I don't know from firsthand discussing with policymakers in Cambridge, that they're trying to make provision that if you have a legitimate exemption, you can still come to school, because the alternative is the school has to provide a very expensive alternative mechanism of educating each child. And it's not clear that they have the resources or capacity to do that. So they're, I assume, trying to keep the exemptions at a minimum and then make it possible for those students to continue to come to school. And at the same time, to create maximum incentives for people to get vaccinated. In other words, most people want to participate in all those kinds of extras. So it's an additional incentive if you're on the fence to go ahead and get vaccinated, because otherwise you're not going to be able to participate.
By the way, what have schools done, public schools through the ages, for all these other vaccine mandates? Do they let those kids come to school?
That's a good question. And I think if there are legitimate exemptions, they have let them come to school.
But, Paul, you've mentioned exemptions a few times. My reading of this, at least the Globe story, I haven't read the actual order from the Cambridge School Committee. My reading is you don't need an exemption. If you choose, because I don't feel like it, to get vaccinated, you can't go to sports or extracurricular, but you can still come to class, right? I mean, that is the way it seems to read.
Well, like you, I've not read the actual text of the motion that was approved by the committee. And from the press coverage, you're right. It does sound like that's possible, that it could be a matter of choice. It's also the case that, the more people you have who take an exemption, the riskier the situation becomes, because even though people are wearing masks, evidence suggests that the most spread happens when people have their masks off and they're eating in cafeterias or they're in common spaces and having a drink of something and so on and so forth. So risk factors go up to the degree that you allow that. So it would be interesting to get an answer to that question, Jim.
Couple of things about this, since it is my hometown. One, for those who think we're all elitists in Cambridge, if you read the Globe story, you see that there are people, their parents, as stupid in Cambridge as there are anywhere in the country. Their parents testifying, say, my children are not your guinea pigs, are not the property of Pfizer, the vile vaccine. It's an experiment. I mean, enough already. Shut up. That's number one. Number two would also disturb me, and I meant to bring this up with you last time we spoke, I think. The superintendent, whom I don't know, whose name is Victoria Greer, is quoted in this paper saying that the mandate aligns with the Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association's recommendation that eligible student athletes be vaccinated. I want to just comment on the MIAA, which I'm sure you have a lot of familiarity with from your days as Secretary of Education. They also have no you-know-whats. They didn't mandate that she's wrong in this case. They didn't mandate that athletes to participate in these sports be vaccinated. They, quote, recommended that it happen. They urged
suggested
people to do it.
It might be nice.
In all seriousness, what is the problem poll I sound like I'm blaming you, like you made the decision.
No.
What is the problem with these people?
Well, I mean, the problem has essentially become a political problem. And this
in Massachusetts?
This is the issue in society. Sure, there are people around who regard this as a significant cultural identity, a sort of tribal issue with respect to our current politics in the United States, having to do with the power of government to control individual decisions. And people are ready to go to war for this. And the consequences, even if it's a small minority, how this is spilling over into school board meetings, school committee meetings, to, you know, threats and, outright attacks on school leaders, one kind or another. People are dancing. You know, so when you get associations like this trying to determine where they want to land as a policy position, they're being cautious. They're trying to sort of maneuver around these sorts of really divisive conflicts that that have consequences in their community and consequences in their politics. But on the other hand, it's not clear that that's the smart thing to do in the interest of public health. So there's a real division there.
You know, by the way, while I don't like it, you describe it well. It's coincidental, but we asked our coworkers to put together a little sound from some of the fights that have erupted, not in Alabama, not in Mississippi, but in New England school board meetings over school mask mandates. And by the way, the middle one is in Dracut right here in Massachusetts. The last one's from Connecticut. Just listen to what some of these school committee members have to deal with.
So at this point, I'm happy to, if there are any questions for the media, we could take those after the fact. Thank you so much for attending today. Thank you.
Excuse me, we're not going to like what's coming for us? Was that what you just said?
Yes, the Nuremberg trial. You're
torturing your child.
Child.
Okay.
Not your child.
Okay.
You can put a mask on your child.
Okay.
You are violating my rights right now.
This is a danger.
You are remiss.
Listen to these sadistic dopes from Dracut. I mean, in all seriousness, the school board member says, excuse me, we're not going to like what's coming to us. The parent shouts, yes, the Nuremberg trials. The parent says, you're torturing my child. I mean, this is unbelievable. I assume you get calls. We know that the Justice Department has been asked by the National Association of whatever, school committees and other things, you know, help. I don't know what they can do. Maybe you do. I assume you get calls from school board members. I mean, beyond the political consequences.
Board members and school leaders are beside themselves.
What are they doing? And by the way, they're great personal risk, too, because these people are totally nuts.
You know, people are out there carrying signs saying, we know your phone number. We know where you live. You will pay the consequences for this. It's gotten visceral. It's irrational. It's, it's a kind of got to be sort of a tribal jihad here on the whole topic.
So what advice do you give? I mean, if you're a principled, which I assume most school committee members are, because it takes a lot of your time for little or no pay, you're a principled person, but who is worried that my 9 and 11-year-old you know, go to school by themselves during the day, and these people are crazy. What advice do you give them?
Well, you know, a couple things. Number one, I welcome the federal intervention here in terms of the attorney general saying we are going to take steps and we're going to advise law enforcement down the line to pay attention to violations that are occurring, to threats that are mm-hmm. occurring, to intimidation that's occurring at the local level, and I'm advising, you know, local officials to take advantage of law enforcement. It may not be that in the typical suburban town, you typically had to have law enforcement at a school board meeting, but you may need to do that. People need to be held accountable. We do have laws that prevent people from, it's not an exercise of free speech to be outright threatening the safety and well-being of a individual policymaker and his or her family. So we're going to have to start moving toward a greater kind of enforcement legally of what sorts of behavior are tolerable at a school board meeting. And if the behavior is intolerable or out of order, then the room has got to be cleared.
So going forward then, Paul Revel, I guess what we can expect here is that we learned today that Pfizer is asking for approval of their vaccine for younger kids, 5 to 11. We already have the vaccine available for teenagers, although a lot of them aren't taking it, 12 to 17, that we're just going to continue to play Russian roulette in the schools No one's going to mandate vaccinations, and kids will take their masks off routinely, and we'll never get out of this mess. I mean, that's what
We're just going to see a scatter, as we've seen, you know, throughout the pandemic, a scatter of policy responses, you know, depending on the politics and the general culture in the particular area you are. So just as we've seen, only a very few districts have mandated vaccines for students in Massachusetts so far. And similarly, across the country, we have 50 different states, and within each of those states, different approaches being taken by different communities. And so, you know, this is America. This is the resistance to centralized power that grows out of our colonial experience and their origins and for why it's part of the culture. But it's being carried now to an extent that has turned, you know, what is a health issue and a real and present threat to the health of the nation and the health of many citizens, and a 700,000 person death toll so far. And we're talking about this in terms of politics now and political parties. Well, and it's just it's out of control and it's out of bounds.
You know, I listened, I forget which one it was, or I credit it, to a podcast the other day talking about how the anti-vaxxers very astutely, who had been around for a while, you know, after the autism, even after the autism vaccine link was debunked.
Sure, we've always had that group.
Yeah, we've always had that group. But that they brilliantly anticipated that COVID would be an opportunity for them to become widely powerful. And I think they have. I mean, they've manipulated all these people's assumptions about vaccinations, because obviously – no school district, I mean, we've routinely said you're going to get measles, mumps, and rubella, you're going to get whooping cough, you have to get all these vaccines, chicken pox, before you come to school. So there's no legal leg to stand on, because it's a vaccine like those vaccines. But they've really co-opted millions of Americans, I guess.
Well, one of the interesting things to watch, Marjorie, is that in a lot of states right now, there's growing pressure from one side of this conversation to add the COVID-19 vaccines to the list of required vaccines for people coming to school. That, you know, in a healthcare crisis of this magnitude, that would have been, former times, been almost automatic.
Right.
Most governors realize if they move in that direction, there'll be a political firestorm. So again, people are dancing around having to make that decision. And it's a very... you know, it's a very obvious case where you see the tensions that are tearing us apart as a society and right now revolving around this particular topic. But these kinds of differences are pervasive and apply to lots of other topics. I mean, we're having similar battles at school boards over critical race theory, for example, which has become another hot button issue that winds up in the jurisdiction of school boards, about which people feel passionately.
But if I'm wrong, Paul, that is a college level course, critical race theory. But
historically, it has been, or a graduate level course. Yeah. But it's symbolic. I mean, it's one of these terms that's been taken and deliberately distorted to mean a whole range of things, from, you know, affirmative action to diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, to even mentioning the topic of race or you know, Jim Crow, or anything that comes up now as being lumped together under critical race theory, which is deliberately misinterpreted and become a rallying cry for a vast campaign to turn back the clock in terms of racial justice in this country.
We're talking to Paul Revel from I don't mean currently like he's gone somewhere, but I mean, I suppose that what he used to do, he's at Harvard. Speaking of Harvard, I'm sure you knew this. According to some data released in a lawsuit, if you apply to Harvard, children of alumni are nearly six times more likely to be admitted than non-children of alumni. Children of alumni are called legacy admissions. At Yale, 14% of the freshman class legacy, 13% at Dartmouth, 10% at Brown, et cetera, et cetera. There is a big movement afoot that urging donors to and others to boycott giving to schools that allow legacy admissions. The basic notion is it perpetuates the discrimination or the imbalance that exists in a lot of elite colleges. one of the leader of this movement is quoted as saying, why should colleges give a leg up to people who already have so many advantages? One, where are you in this legacy admission thing? And two, what's your assessment, wherever, regardless of where you are, about the likelihood of this ever being eliminated in light of the fact that I'm assuming it is a, if not the primary source of revenue for these universities?
Well, there are a number of lenses through which you can view a controversy like this one. On a pure equity basis, there's no question that the analysis provided by this movement, that this perpetuates inequity, that it is, you know, that it is a mechanism through which we retain privilege in the quarters in which it's already vested in our society. Mm-hmm. In other words, we reproduce the existing social order. This is one of the mechanisms for holding that system in place. And so if you're concerned about equity, there's really no case that you could make for, legacy admissions. On the other hand, you have these institutions themselves who feel, we're a private institution. Some of they receive public funds in terms of money that students get for scholarships or grants that they get from the federal government. But they're still, 501c3 nonprofit independent organizations. And, to a certain degree, they survive on funds that they're able to raise from donors. They feel it ought to be within their range of prerogatives to reward certain benefits to those who are generous toward them or loyal toward them or both. And so the institutions are inclined to want to preserve these sort of legacy admissions. I come down on the equity side of the equation. I don't think there's a good case in this day and age when these institutions are standing up in all sorts of other ways to make the case that education ought to be equitable and fair, and we should step back from the kind of privilege that we have enjoyed for so long. And I think the students or alums who are coming forward with this are being courageous. Whether it will be successful in the long run, I have my doubts as to whether it's going to capture a lot of donors who are going to withhold their donations based on this issue. But I think it will capture a lot of support of young alums who are, as these institutions have made efforts. So, Harvard has made an enormous effort to do, need-blind admissions. And many of the elite institutions have moved in that direction so that your
thanks to the much-reviled Larry Summers, by the way. Didn't Larry Summers just put this whole needs-based admission on steroids, essentially, at Harvard, didn't he?
Yeah, it was during his period that he did, and other institutions, Princeton did it, and others are, to the degree that they can afford it, they're following. So that's a good step in the right direction, but it still depends, how many people are being able to take advantage of that.
Sure.
And if you have an overwhelming majority who are coming in from privileged backgrounds in the first place, then that doesn't go very far. And so overwhelmingly, the data show that our elite institutions are serving the children of the elite. And if we want to change that, then that privilege needs to be surrendered at some level, and the opportunity and access need to be shared. It's the battle we've been having over the exam school, just at a higher level in the education system.
Yeah, so Paul, we only have a minute left, but just so I understand a little bit better, if Larry Bacow, for example, was on the show with you, and we were to say, a lot of your career has been about equity, you've talked a lot about equity, how can you defend a system where disproportionately white and affluent kids, legacy kids, get into Harvard at six times the rate of non-legacy kids? I know you don't speak for Larry Bacow, but what might his answer be? What possible defense? What is he going to say? We need the money. We only have a $40 billion endowment. What does he say, Paul Revel?
Well, okay. First of all, I have to underline, I do not speak for
Larry.
We
know that. Okay, fine.
He's a friend and a leader who I very much admire, and you'd be putting him in a very hot spot. And I would expect him to reiterate his commitment to equity, to indicate that they're probably thinking about doing something to curtail this level of privilege that gets exposed in this situation. But at the same time, wanting to defend the prerogatives of the institution as an independent private educational institution, to do some things from time to time to honor those who've been loyal and generous with the institution. Yeah.
I just want to mention, I love the fact that the guy that's leading the charge here is the son of immigrants from Vietnam, another first-generation kid that did fantastically well, got into Brown, but he was afraid he wouldn't get into Brown. He's from California, even though he had top grades and was co-editor, because his parents were Vietnamese immigrants and they weren't wealthy millionaires or they weren't legacies. So good for him.
Yeah, before you go.
I thought that was outstanding, and I love Brown graduates. My son's a Brown graduate, and they have an equity activism streak in them that goes a long way. So I think this is a good thing to stand up.
That's a great school.
By the way, can I also, because I'm sure we're going to get email on this, you know, I went to the University of Pennsylvania. Most
were you a legacy, Jim?
Most people thought I couldn't get in. And I just want to make it clear, the fact that my father and uncle were honors graduates had nothing to do, and donors, had nothing to do with my admission many years
ago. I had no legacy status, and somehow I made it anyway, Jim.
So shocking.
And they didn't even make you a fake athlete, Marjorie.
Paul, it's good to speak to you.
We got to talk to you about that, because that case is
We're
going to
have
a
jury verdict by next week,
the
I'm
Varsity
sure.
Blues case. Can't wait
Varsity
to see what
Blues.
Happens there.
Yeah, let's move back to that. We've got some local aspects to that.
Be well, Paul. Talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Paul Revels.
Okay, well, thank you both.
Okay, talk soon. Paul Revels, the former Secretary of Education and professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. I didn't know you were a legacy, Jim.
I said I was not a legacy. I got in on my merits. Well, I would argue I got in on the merits. Now, I did mention on my application that my father and uncle went there. I did mention that.
That makes you, you know what that makes you, Jim?
No.
A legacy.
Thank you. Let's move on.
Okay. His latest book is co-authored with Lynn Sachs. Paul Revels' latest book, that is, it's called Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, a Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Coming up, why is it taking so long for COVID vaccines to be approved for younger kids? A big movement on that today, but we're not quite there yet. Stay tuned for some answers on Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marge Regan. The first COVID vaccine was approved under emergency use authorization nearly 10 months ago. Nearly 200 million Americans are fully vaccinated against a disease that's responsible, as you know, for the worst pandemic in our nation's history. And while Pfizer did ask the FDA this morning for emergency use authorization for its vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds, why did it take so long? As Dan Carpenter writes in a recent opinion essay for the New York Times, the way America has set up its drug approval process doesn't allow it to quickly respond in the time of a pandemic. Carpenter is a professor of government at Harvard University, oversees the FDA project, a theoretical, historical, and statistical analysis of pharmaceutical regulation in the U.S. as it's carried out by the FDA. His most recent book is Democracy by Petition, Popular Politics in Transformation, 1790 to 1870. He joins us now to discuss the barriers and systemic weaknesses at play when it comes to vaccinating kids. Dan Carpenter, welcome to the show. It's very good to talk to you.
Thanks, Jim. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. So let's get right to it. Why has it taken so long to get these vaccinations for kids?
Yeah, I don't think there's a single answer. The fact is that the FDA can't approve anything until there's actually a submission to it. Mm-hmm. And so the necessary step, as you described, was taken this morning by Pfizer. So at least one thing I think we want to ask, and I don't know that we've really got good data on this, is why it took so long for pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and BioNTech and Moderna, especially these mRNA vaccines, messenger RNA vaccines, to test the drugs in kids. There's different reasons why they might be worried about doing so. There are some, you know, safety issues. Getting the dosing right is problematic. We don't know a lot about how the kids market for vaccines differs from the adult market for vaccines, especially for a new disease like this. But it's certainly possible that there's also an economic relative disincentive for companies to go after the children's market, especially given that a lot of parents, I think a recent poll said that just about one third of parents would immediately get their kids 5 to 12 years old vaccinated once the EUA is issued, which it probably will be here in within a month, say. I don't know the exact timing on that. But if you think that sooner or later, half to 60%, 70% of adults were going to get vaccinated, well, there's just more people in that market, and it's a more profitable market.
But don't you say, I think in your Times piece, that one of the things the FDA could do in a circumstance like this is essentially force the testing, force the trials to happen for different demographics, in this case, like 5 to 11-year-olds, no?
Yeah, and, you know, that might be seen as a controversial suggestion, but sometimes, you know, I think there are a lot of cases where, economic incentives and public health priorities align well. And I think we saw, you know, one of the quickest rollouts of a vaccine in history, right, in part because there were clear incentives. But I think the slowdown on the kids part, and I think we're just going to need some social science, economic research into this, certainly is one problem. And if we get, you know, further development of things like the Delta variant or another virus or another pandemic comes along and it affects children, we're going to need to examine things like that. The idea is, okay, if you are, if you say Pfizer and or Moderna are making lots of money in this marketplace, in part because the FDA has authorized and declared safe and effective your vaccine, in part because some of these companies relied either explicitly on government funding like Moderna, or at least in part implicitly on the technology that funded it, like Pfizer. Well, then, you should be rolling these things out for kids ASAP. There are certainly regulations. You might need a change in statute to do that. But I think it's a solution worth looking at. The children's market for vaccines and for drugs is generally underserved. This is a more common problem. The only time when you tend to get an exception to that rule is rare kids' diseases, like, say, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. But that's in part because of the Orphan Drug Act that provides immense incentives for companies to go after those kinds of small disease markets.
But elaborate on the point that you made in your piece about how the FDA really wasn't, or the system in general wasn't set up for emergency situations like this. It was you know, the number of people you had to have in the tests and the trials, rather, the extent, the length of time of the trials,
how much staff you need to do the analysis.
I mean, are there completely all these rules and regulations that kept this from happening more quickly?
It's a great question, Jim and Margaret. I mean, basically the system we have now for approving vaccines began way back in 1902. Basically the idea was you had to test something in humans before marketing it. And after 1938, especially, that system kind of became much more rigidly defined. The 1902 legislation was the Biologics Control Act of 1902. And the 1938 legislation was the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. And that gave us the world that we have. And so, for instance, when Jonas Salk, and you might remember this, and, you know, this will date us, but my grandfather was health commissioner of Milwaukee when Jonas Salk was rolling out the polio vaccine.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it was a different time then, but you know, Salk, before he was able to market it, or before they were able to market, they had to have massive clinical trials, and largely aimed at children, in 1954. And then the real rollout of that vaccine happened in 1955. The difference is, of course, is that we already knew a lot about polio in 1955, and the science was still evolving. For a lot of things, for a lot of diseases out there, even cancer, and this might sound as a crude way to put it, but we have more time than we had in COVID. The diseases aren't as infectious, or aren't infectious at all.
Yeah.
Or we have other treatments. So for many cancers, yes, many cancers are deadly without the right chemotherapy. But even for many cancers now, we have surgery, we have radiation, and there exists some forms of chemotherapy. For COVID, there was nothing, right? And it was a new disease. There was simply no treatment. And we have a system that kind of works, which is this emergency use authorization. But what we don't really have is, you know, a great system that responds to things midstream. So what happened here was, they were beginning to test the things in kids. And then all of a sudden they noticed that people were developing heart problems, especially adolescents. Right. And so the heart problems were one of two kinds, what's called myocarditis, which is basically internal to the heart tissue, and pericarditis, which is basically the tissue that surrounds the heart. And you were getting inflammation there. And it can be serious. It was pretty rare, but they were concerned about this. And in part, they were concerned because before the Delta variant, the infection rate, the hospitalization rate, and the death rate among kids was very, very low. I don't want to say, I'm sure that there are tragic stories out there of hospitalizations and deaths among children, but it was far, far lower. The Delta variant changed that. It literally changed the ballgame. And so, you know, what you've got is a world where we need some degree of flexibility built into the system, where the FDA can say, well, we're looking for a larger sample size here, say, you know, 5,000 as opposed to 3,000 kids, or we might be looking for, you know, 4 to 6 months of safety data on kids as opposed to 2 months. But, oh, the Delta variant has come along and we need to basically, adapt. And I would argue that that's something that we kind of generally need to build into our systems. The emergency use authorization, for what it's worth, really wasn't even set up for this kind of setting. It was basically in response to bioterrorism. It was a September 11th thing.
Yep.
And so there was legislation in what, 2002, 2004 and 5, 2006. And it was basically the worry of, okay, suppose some group of terrorists or some, you know, foreign state releases a bioterror weapon. You're going to need to be talking about, you know, emergency use authorization of something within days or weeks in those cases, not the kind of thing that we're dealing with here. And so one of the things I wanted to suggest, and I'll stop here on this point, the European Union just created a new umbrella agency to respond specifically to pandemics, because they are different. And I think we should think about doing the same kind of thing. I think we've already got a lot of the architecture. The FDA is very adaptive. The CDC also, but less so, I would argue. And I think we need to think about, a particular kind of pandemic situation that would necessitate, changing our rules and our institutions along these lines.
We're talking with Dan Carpenter, who's professor of government at Harvard and expert on pharmaceutical regulation in the United States. So, you know, part of me thinks, I'm arguing against myself, that even if they had gotten the kids vaccines sooner, we would have such a trust problem that it might not have mattered because the country's so divided. And you touch on the trust issue in a piece you wrote about the rollout of this Alzheimer's drug, pointing out that there were rare bedfellows, Bill Cassidy, Republican from Louisiana, Elizabeth Warren, Democrat from Massachusetts, who both didn't like the USDA DA's approval of this Alzheimer's drug. And you talk about the FDA losing its credibility. Tell us what you said.
Yeah, I think this is a big issue. So on that point, you know, there was a lot of controversy over the drug Aduhelm or aducanumab. Yep. And the way, and particularly the way it was approved. And there were a lot of procedural irregularities to the decision. And I won't go into those. You can see the point, the piece you're mentioning is in the Washington Post. An important scholar in this field, who's both done a lot of research on drug development and also on the FDA, Dr. Aaron Kesselheim, and I've worked with him some. He was one of the people who resigned from the advisory committee,
right?
In part because of these procedural irregularities.
Good for him.
Well, I think this is the key. Is that now what we've seen is that Biogen is reportedly laying off people. Biogen is the developer, the company mm-hmm. behind aducanumab. Mass General recently announced that they're not going to use it. Cleveland Clinic had already announced that. And what's sad is that a potentially promising treatment for Alzheimer's, in part because the FDA rushed its procedures and pushed it over the finish line prematurely, that it's not so much that the public doesn't trust it. I think that's part of it. It's that the people who make the prescription decisions right. Don't trust it. And that, to me, I think, is a small window into a much larger phenomenon. Most of the time, you know, the three of us don't think about the pills that we put in our bodies because we assume that somewhere somebody has vetted them. And that's a really important benefit to our larger system. You wouldn't get innovation, you wouldn't get investment if people didn't trust the things coming out of the process. And that's a really critical function of the FDA. It's not just to keep us safe. It's to buffer and support public trust in a market that is defined by its innovation. And so you can see similar things that went on with the vaccine. So, you know, my colleagues and I have been studying this. You might recall a little over a year ago, they rolled out this convalescent plasma treatment for the vaccines. And there was a big controversy because the then commissioner of the FDA stood with President Trump on the podium at the lectern. And basically they kind of, and, you know, it was right in the middle of an election. And he kind of scientifically misspoke about the benefits of the drug. And it looked like he was kind of being obsequious and kind of, you know, assisting Trump's reelection campaign. I'm not going to get into, you know, Trump v. Biden partisan politics here, but it wasn't a very comforting scenario. In the weeks that followed, several things happened. You know, vaccine hesitancy as expressed in surveys, which is actually a very good predictor of actual vaccination, an inverse predictor, right? The higher people express right. their likelihood of not wanting to take the vaccine, the less they actually do. We know that. It plummeted. It plummeted about 15 percentage points within the following several weeks. And it was particularly among Democrats and independents, in part because they saw that the FDA was being tethered to Trump.
Yep.
And that wasn't just talk. The stock prices for Pfizer and Moderna also dropped, even as the general stock market and the stock market in the pharmaceutical industry basket was rising. So investors also became worried that the market for these vaccines would be right. So what these two stories tell us, I think, is something much more general. When the FDA doesn't follow through on its procedure, people lose trust
right.
and markets begin to fail in these drugs.
We're talking to Dan Carpenter. Dan, we only have a couple of minutes, but I am fascinated by, when I introduced you, I mentioned your book, Democracy by Petition, Popular Politics and Transformation, 1790 to 1870. I read your piece in the Boston Review about the menthol cigarette citizens petition recalls the lost political yeah. tradition. I just want to briefly, really briefly, talk about it for two reasons. One, because I have a question that I've wanted answered for a long time. And two, because it gives me an opportunity to play sound from Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court confirmation hearing when Ben Sasse, who's a Republican senator from Nebraska, asked her to name the five freedoms of the First Amendment. Here's what now Justice Coney Barrett had to say.
Speech, religion, press, assembly. Speech, press, religion, assembly. I don't know. What am I missing?
Redress or protest.
Okay.
You know, by the way, I don't know if you ever saw the great study done out of, it sounds like you're a Midwestern or the Minneapolis Tribune or whatever, where they polled people in America. I think it was about 2012, and something like 1,000 to 1, people could name the 5 members of the Simpson family, and none of them could name the 5 freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment. And that fifth one, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, and I know you wrote a book, we'll have you back to talk about the larger topic. What does it mean? I mean, does it mean formal petitioning? What does it mean? And I hadn't thought about it until I actually read about your book. What does it mean, quickly, if you can?
I'd love to talk about that with you guys further, because it's an aspect of American politics that we've lost. And so the kinds of petitioning, you know, the first month of every Congress back in the 1800s was spent reading petitions and responding to them.
Wow.
The response did not always mean the petitioner got what they wanted. The response could be no, but at least you got a response. Same was true with state legislatures. Same was true with a lot of the bureaucratic agencies, the small bureaucratic agencies at the time. And I've asked people sometimes to compare the average day of, you know, Congress then and now, which, as we know, is mostly spent fundraising. And it's so tethered to the kind of campaign cycle. And it's not surprising at some level. You could, you know, we're picking on Justice Coney Barrett here. But you could pick on just about, you know, a massive number of, of the people who don't know this. And it was, you know, people used to, I don't know what the right metaphor is. People used to kind of think about their petitions in the same way that, you know, we carry around our cell phones and our smartphones. It was deeply a part of the culture. It was a way you established literacy. It was a way that you communicated with officials. And it didn't matter if you couldn't vote, because women, African-Americans, Native Americans, and many white men without property early on in the Republic couldn't vote. And but they could all petition. And part of the argument I make in that book is a lot of them used petitions to do things that we today regard as, you know, bringing democracy to the United States.
And really quickly, when you say the first days of the legislative session were spent considering petitions, is that because members of Congress considered it to be a constitutional right under the First Amendment for people to bring those petitions to Congress, and thus they had to at least consider them even if they didn't approve them? Is that?
In a word, yes. It was clearly a right for people to do that. But it was also considered an obligation, you know, a duty to respond to citizens, even if they didn't vote for you, even if they didn't vote. And again, I think we've lost that. We've lost the kind of norm of complaint and response over the long run. And a lot of it, by the way, has migrated to, well, we you know, Congress has basically now given that to agencies, which is why that menthol petition was so important. But it shows how much the system is withered, because most people won't interact with agencies. They'd prefer to interact with their member of Congress or state legislature or, you know, town selectmen, things like that.
We're going to have you back. I'm fascinated by it. Would love to talk more. Dan, thank you so much for your time
today.
Dan. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim and Marguerite. Keep up the great work.
Thank you very much. Dan Carpenter is a professor of government at Harvard University. He also oversees the FDA project, a theoretical, historical, and statistical analysis of pharmaceutical regulation in the United States. His most recent book that Jim was just talking about, Democracy by Petition, Popular Politics and Transformation from 1790 to 1870. Okay, coming up. Massachusetts lawmakers are considering changes to a recent animal welfare law, leaving us with a potential egg shortage. That is next. Food news, more of it as well, on Boston Public Radio, 8970 GBH, with our food man, Corby Kummer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Join us online to talk through the latest headlines about food policy, industry, and how we eat is Corby Kummer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Program. Easy for me to say. Try that again, Jim. Corby Kummer is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program. Thank you. That's at the Aspen Institute. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, I can say that, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Good afternoon. So well said.
Thank you. Thank you
so, Corby Kummer, before we get to the possible egg shortage around here, I want to talk to you about a workers' strike against Kellogg's cereal plants. And it looks like the workers are paid pretty well, but they have complaints about health care and their benefits and stuff. But I'm wondering if a strike like this, which would be very significant to getting our cereals that we like, is any different now post-pandemic with all this talk about employees having more power, people being more enamored of unions again, a different climate.
I love it. What's different now post-pandemic is the idea that collective voice of labor can count. We see it in the food industry, every place, especially in slaughterhouses. The more of that, the better. In restaurant industry, in food industry, and now we're seeing it for Mexico. With Kellogg, the main issue is they don't want more jobs going to Mexico. And the threat always is, we're going to send jobs to Mexico if you start grousing. So just put up with our conditions or shut up. And, you know, they have this great talking point, which is, this is a union guy saying, a lot of Americans probably don't have too much issue with Nike or Under Armour hats being made someplace, even our cars. But when they start manufacturing our food where they're out of FDA control or OSHA control, I have a huge problem. So OSHA, Occupational Safety Health, which has been revivified under Biden because it was completely dead and castrated under Trump. These are U.S. protection policies that are really important that we don't know that Mexico and China and other countries have. And when it comes to food, people are very emotional. And food workers at Kellogg are playing on this. They're using this. They're saying, you don't want Tony the Tiger coming from some other country and, somehow endangering your children. In fact, these protections, worker protections, should be in place in every international, every overseas manufacturing plant. But food unions are using it against management. And I think that part's great.
Anything else? Would you like to add anything on that, Jim? Or that you're reading the email instead of listening to Tony?
No, I heard every single word, and I was totally convinced by Corby's. I don't know if that'd be argumentative. I found it to be very compelling.
Okay. Well, then let's move on to something else. We like to talk about restaurants.
I'll talk about this one. Go ahead.
Jim particularly likes to talk about restaurants. You noted that there's a study that finds that there's almost 51% of these restaurants, these small restaurants, really struggle to pay their rent in September. On the other hand, we have Guy Fieri, the big guy, big star from the Food Network, coming in to open a store in a restaurant in Boston as early as November 15th. So first, let's talk about the small restaurants, then we'll get to Guy Fieri.
You know, there's nothing good about this news. And the news is that pandemic recovery isn't going along as speedily or as smoothly as anybody wants. That Delta variant is really putting a dent in the new income that restaurants were looking forward to help pay off the debts of the pandemic. And it is really important to call on Congress to add more money to the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. As you might remember, that was a really good fund. That was the first time that Congress was actually recognizing the need to give direct money to restaurants. The Independent Restaurant Coalition had a rally last week at the Capitol saying you've got to add more money because of the 370,000 owners who applied to this fund in the spring and the summer, 265,000 were turned away. That need didn't go away. Restaurants reopened. The summer was going to be great. And then Delta came and they're still hurting. And what you see is that between August and September, more restaurants couldn't pay their rent. there was a rise between August and September. And I think that all of us optimistically thought, I still wish it were the case, that restaurants would be healthier as every month goes by, more people are vaccinated, more people can go out. But in fact, all expenses are going up, food costs, labor, the so-called labor shortage, which is much less a shortage than restaurants being forced to pay more and competitive wages to food service workers than they were able to before. The arithmetic isn't working out for them. Rise in rent, rise in wages, rise in food costs, they aren't able to make it. And Congress has to help by putting more money into the Restaurant Revitalization Fund.
So, but is there any appetite? That's a talk about a horrible choice of words. I was going to say, is there any appetite for it in Congress when they're dealing with these multi-trillion-dollar things? Even though there seems to be generally pretty bipartisan support for restaurants, because every district, no matter what your politics are, obviously has a lot of small independent restaurants. Is there a willingness to spend? I mean, this, by the way, this story is a nightmare. I mean, half of the damn small restaurants in this country couldn't pay their rent in September, and winter 51%. Hasn't even started, you know, considering that for a lot of them, they were able to do outside thing, which is going to disappear in a couple of months. I mean, this is a harbinger, unless this virus just disappears in the next few months, which it's not going to do. This could be the final blow for these places.
It was a wake-up call to me, who was optimistically thinking that restaurants were able to start recouping some of the money, paying back some of the debt, and able to pay their rent. But, you know, eviction moratoria, a lot of pandemic benefits.
Yeah.
In all realms, the federal government has acted as if they addressed this. And I think
right.
that Chuck Schumer was the one who got Restaurant Revitalization Fund put into effect. And the Independent Restaurant Coalition has to say, wake up, it's not over. And when I saw this 51% can't meet rent figure, I thought, wow, restaurants are still in really bad trouble. And we thought that everybody was over the worst.
You know, when Marjorie introduced this topic, she mentioned Guy Fieri opening a second restaurant here. And there's a story in the Globe that has a very disturbing element to it. I'd like you to read it. They mentioned when he came to town recently and his restaurant, which would be on Tremont Street, right in the midst of Emerson College, a ton of Emerson College kids waited outside. This is the deeply disturbing paragraph. It's a testament to the buzz the spiky-haired, sunglasses-bedecked personality is known for creating. And it's the kind of energy, here it comes, Fieri added, that he hopes to bring to Beantown. With the opening of Guy Fieri's Boston Kitchen and Bar. I mean, this is really a make-or-break issue for me. Are we willing to welcome any restaurateur into Boston who refers to Boston as Beantown? You can start, Corby. What do you think about this? I mean, you're sympathetic, I know, to restaurateurs, but Beantown, really?
Okay, I'm completely with you. Let's have a moratorium on the use of the word Beantown, or just a litmus test along with vaccination proof to get onto a flight to Boston, as there should be.
There should be.
Will you promise not to use the word Beantown on city property? You know, that's one thing. But drawing a through line to the 51% of small restaurants who couldn't pay their rent in September, Guy Fieri is a big TV personality and has a lot of money. And it's often venture capital money. It's big, impersonal investment money that says this is chains. It just means that the big guys get bigger and you have to have some kind of celebrity.
How is the food
in order
to get
funded?
I've never eaten at a Guy Fieri. I know there's one that opened, I guess, by the Garden. How's the food in these places? Do you know?
Listen, I'm a Guy Fieri virgin, except when it comes to the funniest restaurant review that was ever written, which was by Pete Wells in the New York Times. That was all in the form of questions about Guy Fieri's Times Square restaurant. And it compared a blue cocktail to nuclear waste.
Oh, that was
it said,
course, right.
Have you ever eaten in one of your restaurants? Do you understand there's nothing joyous about your he put joy into the name of all of his cocktails. And of course, it only increased business because it was the funniest restaurant fan ever written. It's one of the best humor pieces of the past 5 or 10 years. It's a classic article. But what it shows is all publicity is good.
True.
It was perfectly fine for Guy Fieri. And, you know, I'd be in favor of Guy Fieri if he was going to say, I'm going to do nothing but give money to local businesses and suppliers. I'm going to prioritize local farms. I'm going to say to local restaurants in Boston, hey, how can I help you guys? Because I'm the big guy in town because I've got a big name, but I want you to help me. And instead, he said to the Globe, these chefs in Boston, they play a different genre of music than me. They're refined classical. I'm punk rock or Southern rock. So, you know, with the back of his hand is saying, oh, those pointy Boston egghead chefs. It's so ridiculous. They're refined classical. I'm punk rock or Southern rock. It's like I'm building my brand in any town I go to, and the heck with you.
You know, but one more plus, because we've been critical. I want to be fair here. The story in the Globe also mentions that he was able to make it from Chinatown to his new restaurant without going to Google.
That's right.
Which is amazing, considering it's a whole two blocks to get
Chinatown. Yeah, I was deeply impressed by this. And the Globe's
It is one block, actually.
Yeah. Credulous reporting.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll report once it opens. We'll talk more about his latest. The other word that I hate as much as Beantown is eatery. His latest eatery in Beantown went once it opens.
Okay.
You know what I think we could do is consign it to Beantown Eatery. Do not enter premises.
Well, give him a break. Give
together.
Him a chance. We're talking to Corby Comer.
We've talked to you a lot about lab-grown meat, Corby, and the idea of this piece in the counter.org. Is that it's supposed to be right around the corner, inevitable, et cetera, but the science says something different. So what does the science say?
It's not just the science, it's the economics. Everything is going against an affordable cell-cultured ground meat hamburger in your meat case, the way it is now affordable to get Beyond Meat, or probably impossible, but definitely Beyond Meat in your produce case. Why is this? So let's go back to what cell cultured meat is. You know, one animal dies instead of millions. One animal dies, they take out cells from it, and then they grow them in a lab and they make hamburger, and you buy it for $17. $17 a pound is the very lowest, very most optimistic estimate, even in the next decade. And it's hundreds or thousands of dollars. $17,000 would be much more like it for what's realistic. It's nowhere near a miracle that's going to take place. All of the projections rely on, it's practically Jetson stuff, the factories of a scale that have never been built, even for the pharmaceutical industry, standards for clean rooms to grow out this cell-cultured meat that are only reserved for pharmaceutical companies, not the cleanliness standards that food manufacturing plants have to abide by. Why is that really important? Because it's like 68, I'm making that up, but I think it's 68 at least, times more expensive to have a clean room up to pharma standards. And a lot of these optimistic projections say, no, no, food standards are going to be fine. In other words, they're all built on lies, or a bunch of hooey is somebody who spent 2 years calls these projections that by 2030 there could be anything affordable in the meat case. And recall, or don't recall because you haven't even thought about this, why would you? The best case is that it's ground meat. There's no way that it's going to create muscle, the fibers of a T-bone steak. That's nowhere near in anybody's plans. It would just be ground meat, the kind you see already in a Beyond Meat plant burger. What's really good is reduce greenhouse gas emissions, improve the use of land, animal welfare. Those things are huge benefits of cell-cultured, or as it's now called, cultivated meat. That is really great, and it's an aspirational goal. One of the overriding points of this enormously long, incredibly convincing piece by Joe Fassler, who spent months on this, and you can see it in the length of the piece in thecounter.org, is governments either decide this is going to be part of their moonshot investment strategies or not. But private venture capital will never be patient enough to wait for this meat to be affordable.
Talking to Corby Cummer. Corby, before you go, we're going to talk to our listeners about this after we bid you adieu. It's a measure on Beacon Hill. It's referred to by the Humane Farming Association as the Rotten Egg Bill. If people don't recall, in 2016, the voters of Massachusetts approved question 3 on the ballot, and it requires that egg-laying hens have no less than 1.5 square feet of floor space so they can actually, I believe, allow them to at least flap their wings kind of thing. Well, it goes into effect, I believe, in January, and the concern of the egg producers is we can't operate under those circumstances. So if it is not amended by the legislature before, there's either going to be a colossal egg shortage or there's going to be a huge increase in prices. Some groups that say they are deeply concerned about the hens are supporting this legislation. Some, like the Humane Farming Association, are not. And it sort of begs the question about how much we really care about the welfare, at least in my estimation, of animals, as when our pocketbook is at issue. What's your take on this effort by the legislature to, quote, they call it, enhance what the voters did 5 years ago?
Oh, my God. That Orwellian language, enhance, which inevitably means lowering the animal welfare standards. First of all, there's not going to be an egg shortage. It's only an economic measure to protect farmers. What caught my attention at first when I saw they're trying to roll back 1.5 square feet of usable floor space to 1 square foot. Oh, they just want to make this less humane. Animals don't have wingspan. They won't really be able to move around. But then I saw that other states that have enacted similar animal welfare regulations have kept it to 1 square foot. And so the industry standard, meaning the affordable equipment that the chicken raisers can buy, is all geared to 1 square foot. Mm. So it does put them on a back foot. It makes it harder for them to afford the equipment. So that made me sympathetic. If the entire rest of the country is going to 1 square foot, but also in this weird parlance, this ridiculous Orwellian speak, there are now multi-tier aviary systems. Multi-tier aviary systems, that means go up vertically and let them fly above. So, okay, maybe they don't have much space. They've only got 1 square foot, but we're going to build higher cages for them. Maybe they'll do that, and they'll have ceilings. But they're using all kinds of excuses to save money. It's like when the meat industry got Trump to declare meat workers essential workers, and right. So the companies didn't have to protect didn't have to repay them for the horrendous deaths, COVID, and usual repetitive motion injuries that plague all slaughterhouse workers. This is another way of the industry just trying to protect itself at the expense of animal welfare. But if the rest of the country has enacted 1 square foot, then maybe Massachusetts should be consistent with that rather than 1.5 square foot.
Okay, but one thing, doesn't going back to 1 foot, as you just said, undermine the reason we voted for this in 2016?
Of course it does. And it's nothing like an enhanced bill.
Okay.
It's only rolling back the bill to protect Massachusetts farmers. And industry is behind it.
By the way, it only passed the House 156-1. So, I mean, it shows that where their heads are at. Corby, it's a pleasure. Next time I'll try to introduce you properly as opposed to...
No. It's always interesting.
By the way, next time you're in Beantown, stop on by, okay?
You know, I've got some eateries on my list.
Okay, fine. That'd be good. Good to see you. Beantown.
Corby,
thank
you very much.
See ya.
Okay, Corby Cummer joins every week. He's the Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a Senior Editor at The Atlantic, and a Senior Lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Thank you, Corby, coming up. So coming up, we are going to open the lines, and Jim is going to man the email, and we're going to talk about this potential egg shortage. As we just said, are you willing to make a commitment to the animals? Or not. That is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So is Massachusetts on its way to an egg shortage? We talked about this a couple of seconds ago with Corby Comer, but now we want to get you in on the conversation. As we said, lawmakers are considering changes to this 2016 animal welfare law, adopted by the voters, by the way. It set higher living standards for egg-laying hens. That law required enough room for the birds to be able to fully spread their wings, that's charitable of us, and have at least 1.5 square feet of usable floor space per hen. But now these standards allegedly, according to the egg producers, not the hens, but the people who own them, have put the state on course for an egg shortage and a price increase, prompting lawmakers and at least some animal rights groups to agree to cut down on the floor space to 1 square foot, provided, and this is a quote, that the hens have unfettered access to vertical space, even though it seems to me if you can't spread your wings, how do you get access to the vertical space? But in any case, I want to hear from you. Is this change allowing the hens nowhere to go but up good enough? Is the first hint of a negative consequence for consumers? Do we allow rollbacks to protections for farm animals? So I guess the question is this. Are you willing to deal with, even if they're telling the truth, Corby thinks they're not, with shortages and price increases, if that's the only way you can protect these birds, and actually it applies to pigs, not the 1.5 square feet, and other farm animals, or is ignorance bliss, meaning don't ask, don't tell, I don't want to know about this, as long as I don't know about it, I am perfectly fine. You can screw the chickens, essentially, or the hens, I guess, in this case. 877-301-8897. Now, as I said, Marjorie, I just read that it passed the House almost unanimously, 156
right.
to 1. But I am dubious that this is a thing that's in the interests of the birds and the pigs and the weather. And by the way, I am the worst example. We often talk about our own hypocrisy on this show. I am one of these people, if it's not right in front of my face and I don't know it, I tend to ignore it if the ignoring of the thing benefits me. Meaning, now that I've read this thing, my attitude is if they change this law, I love eggs. I eat a huge amount of eggs, egg whites, actually. That's offensive, Jim. In any case, I know it offended a lot of people, but I eat a huge amount of egg whites. Exactly. So I'm not going to do it now that I know what
you're
I know.
Do what? You're not going to do what?
If they amend this law, unless I am convinced by some experts this is perfectly fine for the hens, I'm going to put my money where my principles are. Having said that, I know there are a lot of horrible conditions for a lot of farm animals that I ignore because I don't have to pay attention to them. And I feel bad about it, but obviously not bad enough to allow it to affect my choices. How about you?
Well, I'm confused. I
don't
understand why animal rights groups are in favor of this. I have a
piece tell you
from
why.
The Animal Legal Defense. But why?
I'll tell you why. I used to do ballot campaigns, as you know. I won a number of ballot campaigns which the legislature either repealed or threatened to repeal despite the public voting. It is possible, I don't know this for a fact, the legislature said, you have two choices, advocates. You can either agree to this or we're really going to blow the law away. We may even repeal the law. When you read what the Humane Farming Association says, this is actually a rotten egg bill. It's bad for the hens. It's turning these places into egg factories. That may be the motivation. Now, it may also, somebody will call maybe from one of the groups. Maybe the motivation is that it's still. Now, if you thought 5 years ago, and I assume you did your research before you sponsored the ballot question, that they needed 1.5 square feet. All of a sudden, you concluded a third less is okay?
Well,
I don't think
Corby
so.
Answered that question.
I know
right?
he did.
He said the rest of the country has a foot long. And the thing I'm confused about is you go to the supermarket or you go to Whole Foods, go to Trader Joe's, wherever you go, and you can buy the cage-free eggs that are more expensive.
Yeah.
I thought nobody – I hope they're not in cages in the cage-free, or is that another scam too?
Well, I hope not. I buy them cage free. And by the way, places.
And where are they coming from? If all these people are fighting over the 1 foot cage and the 1.5 foot cage, where are all the cage free hens that are running around without cages? Or they say, you know, raised outside, cage free, raised outside. Those are even
more
expensive.
By the way, from what I read, there are 4 cage free hens and they're just laying like crazy. You know, I mean, they are exhausted, but they're doing the right thing, I guess.
Maybe we should stop then, because if the 4 cage-free hens laying legs endlessly, Jim, doesn't seem right for the 4
What was the thing from Seinfeld? Was it fat-free yogurt made in Queens? He went out there and it wasn't fat-free. I mean, that's the sense you get. Sophia in Cambridge, you're first. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent. Thank
Fine,
you.
Fine, thank you.
Screw the legislature. I'm with the chickens.
Oh, I'm with the chickens, too.
You know, Massachusetts either needs to be a leader, not a follower. But more importantly, and this drives me crazy because every time I listen to your conversation with Corby Cummer, I can't believe that he's not whispering those three little words again and again, which is certifiedhumane.org. Mm.
Tell us about it.
Animals with a certified humane label are truly living a free, certified, and lovely, wonderful life in the country, including Nelly's eggs. And there's a whole host of products. There's pork, chicken, beef. All of these animals have been raised using old farming standard methods, which is that the animals get to roam freely and they get to naturally fly and swim and graze and do all the wonderful things that they should do. And yes, you pay more for that because the animal has both lived and died a careful and thoughtful life. And so those farmers have to spend an enormous amount of money to get that certified humane. It's not like organic, where organic can be slapped on anything and it's by anybody's definition. Certified humane is an entirely different level. So we, at least in our household, we source certified humane food through the certifiedhumane.org website. No, I don't work for them. But
So I'm looking at this, Sophia, on my phone right now. It's a rectangle, certified humane, written in royal blue, raised and handled, written in green.
Yes.
So this is what you're talking about, that we should look at this on the product. So when you go into the store to buy your eggs, it isn't enough to buy the cage-free. You need to buy the certified humane, raised and handled, correct?
Correct. So Nelly's eggs are in that category. Pete and Jerry's are in that category. I tend to go with Nelly's only because they were first. They put themselves out there. They were willing to put the money into that farm. And they, if you go in, you'll see them in Whole Foods, Star Market, Market Basket. They're everywhere.
I've seen them.
They fly off the shelves. You will pay more, but you know, you're paying for the life of that animal.
So you mentioned Whole Foods. Now we're getting off eggs to meat, but they have that, and fish, they have that rating system.
One through five.
Yeah. Oh, that rating system is foul.
It's foul.
Another good line by you. Go ahead.
You do not want to go. You actually want to go, and the fish advisory, there's an entire, and Corby Cummer's talked about this as well. You want to go onto that website and you want to determine and see what is really wild caught. I mean, the best thing you always want to go for is wild caught.
Yeah. How do you know this, Sophia? How do you know so much about this?
Because I'm a foodie and I care about my food.
Good for you.
And I really, years and years and years ago, decided that I was going to eat less and eat better. So we tend to be very healthy. We're not crunchy. This is a difference.
Got it.
Because I'm going to go for that bag of Doritos. You better believe it. But when it comes to animal welfare, when I hear people saying, well, you know, I'd be excited to become vegetarian because I hate the way animals are treated, I'm like, well, go on the certifiedhumane.org website. Because you have an alternative, and it means that they don't do massive industrial farming at all.
One last thing, Sophia. We have a lot of calls. I want to move on, but since you're an expert here on the meat thing, though, wild caught obviously is not an issue. So, what do you look for with meat?
I'm looking for that certified humane.
Same thing.
Tag as well.
Okay. All right.
In fact, Springer chicken. I know. So, Jim, if you go to the Market Basket in Somerville, I think it's called Spring or Spring Hill, Springer, you're going to look for it. It's on the right-hand side, almost towards the produce, and they have certified humane chicken.
I'm looking for it Saturday morning. Thanks to you, Sophia. Thank you for your call and your imparting of knowledge to us. We really appreciate it.
Okay, Sophia's with the chickens. I'm with the chickens,
I'm
Jim.
With the chickens,
She's
too,
totally
by
convinced
the way.
Me. She's totally convinced me, although I don't know how I have a sticker on the piece of hamburger, the hamburger pound that's in the, you know, the... behind the glass.
Well, they have it on the display or something, you know?
I've not seen it on the display.
You know what would be really interesting, by the way, which also might contribute to a more humane treatment? Obviously, it's a little selfish on this my part. I should have asked Sophia. Are there hens which only lay egg whites? That's the question that Will in Norwich, you are, I withdraw that question. Will in Norwich, welcome to the show. Thank you for calling.
Keep reading the emails, Jim.
What? Oh, I will.
Hey,
sorry.
How's it going?
Hi, Will.
Great.
Norwood, but
oh, sorry.
I was
sorry.
Calling because, no problem.
I am a vegetarian, so I eat eggs sometimes, but my girlfriend is vegan, and there are actually some pretty good substitutes these days for eggs.
Like what?
That are, there's one called Just Egg, which comes in a little like plastic container, and it fries up just like scrambled eggs.
Really?
It's actually pretty good. Yeah, it's very egg tasting. And then there's ways to do it yourself with just tofu scrambles and black salt. Ends up tasting a lot like eggs. You make like frittatas and scrambles.
What's that first one called? I don't like fake stuff, but I'll give it a try. What's the first thing called again?
Just Egg.
Just Egg. Okay.
Yeah.
Just Egg.
Okay.
If,
so
if you like, if you tried Beyond Burger and you liked it, you know, definitely worth giving it a shot.
I like so it Will, as long as I know I'm not don't know I'm eating it. But go ahead.
We just heard from Sophia or about
Sophia,
this,
yeah.
Sophia about the certifiedhumane.org. So vegetables are not going to have that in the bins at the stores, and there's a lot of controversy about how organic stuff really is. What do you do?
I go to Market Basket and get the cheap vegetables, and then I go to the open market at Haymarket on the weekends and get the cheapest vegetables I can.
So you're not worried about whether they're organic or not?
Either way, I mean, no, not really. Either way, like there is, you know, human rights problems within the agricultural industry.
Yeah.
There's also human rights with meat, and then also animal rights on top. I mean, you know, you remember it came up the meat processors during
right.
COVID.
Of course.
They were all treated. So you're layering that on top.
Hey, Will, thank you for your call as well. By the way, a ton of people, Jeff and Donna are the first two, but there are a ton of others, are saying go to farm stands. You know, go to farm stands, small independent farmers who show up at these farm stands. And you're
but
not only patronizing small business people.
How do you know if they're using pesticides?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that question is. You know, I just realized, in addition to the Seinfeld, do you remember the first episode? I think it was the first episode of Portlandia,
mm-hmm.
where they went, where they're eating chicken. They ordered chicken at a, I'm going to get this slightly wrong, at a restaurant. And they asked if it was, I don't know, cage free, whatever the hell it was. And the server didn't know. So Fred Armistead says, can you wait 1 second? And they get up from the table and they drive out to the farm before they order. I think I got that pretty close to what – not exactly. Carolyn, New Hampshire, we're talking about the what the Humane Farming Association calls the rotten egg bill that apparently is being embraced by the legislature to amend to reduce the space available to egg-laying hens, despite what the voters said in 2016.
Which is so typical of
the
legislature.
Of course it is. Hi.
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 I called yesterday. We spoke about Thanksgiving. Today,
oh, yes.
I just happened to get in the car, and I heard this conversation. I really didn't get the whole thing, but I will tell you, I live in New Hampshire, as you know, and I would question even the certified humane treatment. I would go to Nellie's website, Nellie's Eggs.
That's what Sophia said, Nellie's, yeah.
And check it out and see how are these, you know, how are the hens being raised? I feel everything that we buy and everything I want to eat, every animal, I don't care what it is, has to be humanely treated. And for me, that means hens that are allowed to be outside, access to eat bugs and grass and flowers and everything they want to eat. And I'm lucky because we do live in a small town area, and I can buy my eggs locally from a farm where I can go see the chickens being moved around. Now, they are kept in an enclosure, and the tractor will actually drive that, you know, pull that to different parts of the meadow during the day. So the hens are free-ranging, but they're not just everywhere on the farm because they'd get eaten by predators, obviously. Mm. So I care about that. No hen, no animal should be caged. Pork is treated so cruelly in this country. Pigs are raised in cages. They can't even lay down.
This is horrible.
The way
that is awful.
Pork
it is
at
awful.
All because of, it is awful. And so I think people really have to educate themselves. Look at websites. Look at sourcing.
No, you're right. You're right. You're right.
Everything organic, grass-fed, humanely grazed, humanely slaughtered.
Carol, it's great.
It's
great talking to you. Since yes. Bacon is my favorite food, by the way. I mean, this is You know, I can't believe I eat any of this stuff. Carol, thank you for the call. By the way, to put
I'm
it to the test.
I'm looking at lovely pictures of the hens up at Nellie's.
Carol and Sophia mentioned Nellie's, and this is the test for people. At Whole Foods, I just looked it up. Mm-hmm. They're roughly 2 to 2.25 times as expensive as the lowest end egg, which I'm sure is not humanely raised, because obviously, and so the question is, you willing to pay twice as much for eggs to ensure that a chicken essentially isn't tortured in its life? And God, I would hope if you can afford it that you would. Lauren in West Newton, we only have a minute, and it's yours. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because, you know, I actually worked for Whole Foods for quite a few years, and you know, a lot of, you know, they have the meat there too that is like step 2, step 3, step 4, and it talks about being humanely raised. But what they never talked about in any of our trainings was, is there actually a governing board that goes and checks these farms?
Yeah,
the same thing for eggs. There's no governing body that actually goes and checks. There is, I mean, the USDA certifies organic. They certify biodynamic, which is like, you know, the crazy like organic off steroids. But they don't. But the humanity of these animals isn't actually governed by any governing body. We don't know if any of this stuff is true. You know, farms can be saying this, but there's nobody actually going to spot check to see whether or not these farms are following the practices. And you know, it's unfortunate. Like, you know, I try to buy as much as I can from local farmers and going to the farmer's market, or, you know, buy the free-range eggs. But it's not price. It's price. It's not price effective for a lot of families. And I think it's like unfair saying, well, if you can't afford it, then sorry, you're going to have to keep tortured animals. Like, I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm not trying to be funny, but it doesn't make any sense to me.
Lauren, we're out of time. I'm really sorry. You raised some really important issues, but we'll have to continue them in the future.
I did learn on Nellie's website that I should not be looking for the cage-free eggs. I should be looking for the free-range, and that's what the last call just said, too. So
this is
free-range. It is depressing. Everything's depressing, Jim. But the fall foliage is coming, as I said to Andrew Cabral. We can discuss that. Because we may only have that for a few more years.
You know, I'm going to have a head of lettuce for dinner. I mean, that's the only way I can figure out.
Well, is it organic or not organic?
We're going to continue this conversation.
Did you ask the lettuce how it feels about being eaten?
We got to go. We got to go.
Okay, we are done. Tomorrow we're going to have our Friday All-Stars. Callie Crossy, Shirley the Young, Sue O'Connell, and Andy Inoko. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, and Rebecca Tauber. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. What's on TV, Jim?
Anissa Sabi George will be joining me tonight, one of the two finalists for mayor. Dave McGilvery, obviously the race director for the marathon. The marathon is Monday. Dave will join me. And we love him, Christopher Muther, brilliant travel writer for the Boston Globe, who said in his tribute to Chelsea that I abuse him, so I will try not to verbally abuse him tonight on Greater
He wasn't the
Boston.
Only one.
Well, I didn't say he was the only one, Marjorie. I said he said it. I didn't say he was the only one.
It was a chorus, Jim.
I didn't say he was the only one. I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
Horrible.
Thank you for tuning in. Hope you can tune in tomorrow.
Goodbye.
And have a great day. Bye.
See ya.